Welcome, everybody, to the Thursday, October 19th closed session agenda and meeting. Could I have a roll call, please?
Yes, ma'am. Director Sennett?
Here.
Director Shisenya?
Here.
Director Tacker?
Here.
And President Schicker?
Here.
Thank you.
Okay, reading from the agenda. We will be discussing pending litigation pursuant to Government Code 54956.9B, approximately 15 cases listed on your agenda. The newest one of note that has not been mentioned before is the County of San Luis Obispo versus LOCSD. That is case number ND06-10548, complaint for declaratory relief and injunctive relief. All of the rest of the ones have been listed before. The next item is real estate, meeting in closed session to confer with Dan Blesky, property negotiator, pursuant to Government Code 54956.8, to give instruction regarding to sale of district property, Tri-W and Broderson. And the third item is personnel. The board will meet in closed session under the provisions of Government Code 54957 with regards to matters of public employment, the utilities manager, contract negotiations, and the general manager interviews. We're taking closed session comment at this time. So come on up and speak. Mr. Cooper.
Bo Cooper, Los Osos. I want to continue to advocate for getting rid of Tri-W as an option. I think it's really important. What I have here is a picture, two pictures, of the very first victim of the old board's building, Tri-W. It's a dead deer. It's the first known victims. There are many unknown victims when the bulldozers bulldozed over the habitat of small critters. Right, the people who would do such a thing are unconscionable, and Tri-W site with the gravity plant, with the gravity collection system, becomes the wastewater treatment project that we end up with. Anybody who supports that project is not my friend, is the enemy of Los Osos, is the enemy of the people. Those who do support, like Chuck and Steve, who do support finding an alternative, are people who are my friends. Those who are supported by the taxpayers watch are not my friends. So I advocate for the people who will do good. The first victim, I do not want to be one of the 40% of being the last victim. Thank you very much.
Who else would like to speak this evening? Mr. Dugan?
Dave Dugan, Los Osos. At the forum, there was talk about money's being spent on lawyers, and I see that Taxpayers Watch is still causing us to spend money on lawyers. They're not causing this board to spend money on lawyers. This board represents the taxpayers of the district, and so they're forcing the district, the property owners, to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on lawyers. That's the problem there. There was somebody talking last night how they weren't part of Taxpayers Watch. Three candidates deny that they were, and that there are at least three candidates that I know of that are running on the slate, and I believe those are backed by Taxpayer Watch. George Melonis, utilities manager, contract negotiation. He's a good man, does a good job. I don't think there should be any haggling over the fact, unless he's asking for more money, and I don't blame him. But he reminded me today that the finance and water ops joint meeting, committee meeting, we all suggested a 30% across the board rate raise in the rates of the water if for an interim relief, and this 12% you guys voted on is not going to cover it. And I think you guys need to revisit that as soon as possible, because it's going to make it really hard to get money from the iBank and other sources if we're not going to meet the revenue stream that you guys predicted. With 12%, it's not enough on the base. So other than that, I think, keep George on, and they're doing a job. And one more thing. This lawsuit with the state over the SRF, I believe that this is going to be all she wrote on that lawsuit. And the reason is because 27-01 puts the whole deal into the air. Even the SRF now, so I think it's very questionable whether it was a legal loan or not. But I think as part of the negotiations for bankruptcy, that maybe that should be settled on pennies on the dollar, and we should probably really push really hard for the state to come to us on the table on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker, please. Ms. Cooper.
Okay. Hi, Lacey Cooper. Still in the PZ hood. I'm here to talk about the litigation of the candidates, and she said she was a member of Taxpayers Watch. And these are the people that spent better part of last year trying to dissolve the board. So I know Lynette Toronowski and her husband were out there getting the first signatures to dissolve the board, and we're proud of it. And I spent a lot of hours, about 2 months, trying to prepare a paper to combat what they were saying. They were saying it was a real, they had a paper that was all talking about how great it was to dissolve the board, how we didn't need local government, and now they're running, now Lynette is running for that, which I think is very hypocritical. I asked these people to wait until the election, you know, to run, don't dissolve the board, and they said, no, that we don't have anybody that wants to run. Well, I guess they scraped some people together since they couldn't dissolve the board, and I'm just displeased. It should be called Taxpayers Waste because they wasted a lot of our money and time of the board, our staff and legal counsel on their suits. So I'm hoping they're talking about healing. I think they should drop these lawsuits. They're redundant, ridiculous, and unnecessary. Well, they're not really redundant. They're unnecessary. And about Tri-W, I am worried. The reason I wanted it to be sold is because I'm worried that it will be the home of a sewer plant. There's a lot of push, and all these candidates, Joe Sparks was always for the sewer plant. Lynette Toronowski, of course, is Taxpayers Watch there for the sewer plant in the middle of town. And Maria Kelly is a member of Dreamers and supported by Taxpayers Watch. So if that was the most expeditious, it doesn't matter how expensive it is, they'd want to put it, they want to go along with the county. There's a difference between cooperating and rolling over. And I feel those three candidates are just going to roll over because they think, wow, it's a done deal. It's not a done deal. We have a lot to say, a lot of input, and I want to see good people. So, you know, I want to see Chuck and Steve, and I want to see Dave Dugan, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Who else would like to speak? Ms. McPherson?
Oh, good afternoon, board and staff. It's a gorgeous day today in Los Osos. I'm just having a wonderful time. I've got a bunch of kids outside making noises. I'm sure it's a riot in the back of the room. You don't need to hit the gavel. They're just kids. I notice that there's, you know, still all of these pending litigation, and I just am wondering which of these you're going to be discussing tonight. I know they're just here because you might be discussing all of them or just some of them. I wanted to mention that on this one, LOCSD versus Regional Water Quality Control Board is a designated party, that we have entered some negotiations, of course, with the regional board. Chuck was talking to Harvey Packard a little bit. Everybody wants to find a way of getting out of having to do 5,000 individual hearings. And so we're making some headway there, and I appreciate the board's weekly visits and regular visits to the regional board. I know that, gosh, all of these, I know everybody said Taxpayers Watch and all of these lawsuits, and it is awful to see all of this. I thought that they were going to drop at least the ones against you personally when they attest to. But anyway, I just wanted to encourage you that in the process of going through this, the kids outside were saying, what is a lawsuit? What is court? Is that where everybody goes wah, wah? They see no Judge Judy. And I just wanted to let you know that there's little kids outside who are just dying to come up here and say, that this is not the way to do business. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Barrow.
Thank you. My name is Al Barrow, and just As a brief background, I just want to say that my family was participated in the House of Burgesses, was formed in 1638, which was the first lawmaking body in the United States. So we have a long history of participating in democracy. So this is my turn. Anyway, the first lawsuit that I wanted to refer to is Montgomery Watson, LLCSD, and the second one is LLCSD versus the Regional Board, and the third one is the county's recent lawsuit that was included in the bankruptcy listed here below. And I would like to comment on that. Thank you for your time. The bankruptcy filing was to protect the community. The county has attacked us in the bankruptcy filing on their October 3rd filing. That seems very disingenuous for the county to do that to us, at the same time saying they're going to partner with us and help us with a lawsuit. The whole legislation was to help solve the problem, and I think the county was inappropriate in doing that. And I noticed Mrs. Schicker asked them at the board meeting why they didn't contact us regarding those issues, but instead went to court. When I asked county counsel, he said, read the lawsuit, and I did. And I still think it's an attack on the district, and I'm disappointed in them. It makes it harder to partner with them. The Montgomery Watson lawsuit, I think, didn't have to occur if we had not chosen such an expensive project in the wrong place. And we have a pond system designed for Los Osos. It has five cells in it, and it would adequately treat to the state discharge requirement for about $8 million, all of our effluent. I think that that's something we need to consider. I wish everybody would come to the meeting tonight and get some information or turn on your TV sets. I think the Orenco presentation is going to be a very good one, and they're going to tell us how we can handle it and how we can finance it and how we don't have to depend on the state revolving fund money to do something. And I think that's very good. I want to congratulate you on getting that on the agenda. Thank you.
Thank you. Would anyone else like to speak? Closing public comment. See you at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much. Do you have a quick announcement? Oh, would you like to speak?
Is this? Sorry about that.
Okay.
You can say your name
first. Hi, my name is Hannah.
She wanted to remind everybody to vote on November 7th. Can we get everyone? Thank you for coming to the Thursday, October 19th, open session special meeting of the Los Osos CSD. Could we have a roll call, please?
Director Sennett?
Here.
Director Cesena?
Here.
Director Tacker?
Here.
President Schicker?
Here.
Mr. Fiché is not here this evening. Tonight, we have, before we get started on our agenda, Chief Fineris is here from the fire department. And I just, well, first of all, I have to report out a closed session. And Mr. Murphy, would you help me with that? Please report out of the closed session this evening.
Thank you. In closed session, your board received a report on the current pending litigation, including the bankruptcy litigation, and you discussed issues related to that with the bankruptcy attorneys. That was the general extent of the closed session.
Thank you very much. Okay. Before we get started on our presentation and consent calendar this evening, I just wanted to know if the board had any questions for Chief Fineris, because he's here this evening. Do you have any questions that you'd like to ask him? Chief Fineris, do you have anything you'd like to report? Okay, just he's here available for us if we have any questions, but it looks like we have no questions at this time, and thank you for being here. You're welcome to stay. Okay, it's a special night to have not a meeting on it. Okay, so this evening we have a very special presentation for the audience here in the room and at home. And I'd just like to read what it says on the agenda for those of you at home that may not know. Orenco, which is a company, a wastewater company, represented by Mr. Bill Cagle and Mr. Mike Saunders, will have a presentation and workshop regarding turnkey wastewater project proposal, design, build, and finance options for wastewater treatment facility in Los Osos. Our board is to schedule advisory committee, county, and...
So I think between the county and the CSD, I think most pointedly Noel King's statement that there would only be gravity collection considered for the project, I think we all realize that upon revelation of the Ripley report that the county is going to consider that. There was a recent county lawsuit regarding how we have been handling our fiscal oversight and how they want to influence it. That could have been resolved with a phone call, but it wasn't. And I think in the spirit of cooperation, we'll resolve this with the county. But in the context of tonight's presentation, I wanted to make a statement that this is in no way to be construed, at least on my part, and I'd like to get consensus from the board, that this is not intended as an end run around the county's plan with regard to 2701, and this is only a workshop for informational purposes. It's another alternative, and it's to be viewed in that context. The county will vet this opportunity or this presentation as a another alternative, and it's another tool in our belt to be used in getting a project, whether the county does it or we finally do it. We're in favor of all options being on the table, not only technology and siting, but also the financing and the development of the project. And this is truly another opportunity. So we want everyone to recognize that we're still working under 2701 in a very cooperative manner, and that this is just to open up the door to explain other funding and design, build, and operate opportunities for us. I'm very happy to have this presentation, and I feel it's a real asset to the overall process. Chuck, do you have? Am I getting consensus from the others on the board?
Director Sasania?
I'm in total agreement with that. This is part of the compelling evidence that the county wanted to see. And we're opening up options. We're not closing things down. We're not limiting anything. We're opening things up. And the more options you have, the better things are. This is complicated because design, build, finance is a little bit complicated in terms of authorities and that sort of thing. So we still have some investigation to do, but I certainly appreciate Orenco being willing to come down and meet with our community and give us another viable option that we really, in a direction we hadn't had the opportunity to even explore before. So no end runs, just more on the table.
Thank you. Comment. If anybody in the public is concerned about this, as the member of the liaison committee that's been meeting with the county on a regular basis, I want to assure you that they have been informed, cordially invited personally to this meeting, and also this meeting is streaming on video tonight, and so they've been made aware of that. We've been in contact with them about this. We've been in contact with the assemblyman and the Regional Water Board to make sure that everybody was personally invited, to make sure that they understood that this was another method of us for outreach to them and our community, and offering options for them. And they were pleased to receive the information, and they thanked us for the invitation. So it was also spoken at the Board of Supervisors meeting on Tuesday, a public information to the whole county. And I was there presenting, Director Sasania was there presenting, and Director Tacker was also there. So just wanted to disclose that to the public. Personal invitations, full communication. They have asked us for compelling evidence. For considering other alternatives, we intend to help in any way we can and cooperate in any way we can. We're very interested in that. So with no further words from anybody, I'd like to introduce the team who graciously came this evening, Mr. Bill Cagle and Mr. Mike Saunders.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam President. And thank you all for having us down here. Mike and I are honored to be here. My name is Bill Cagle. And I've been with Orenco for just about 8 years. I've served in different roles there as their business development director, government relations director, and now I serve as the national accounts director there with Orenco. My background is in biology. I have a prior to working at Orenco, I'm a California native, and I was a regulator for 7 years in Placer County, and I was one of the founders of the California On-Site Wastewater Association. San Luis is it brings back some memories for me. Back in the last time I was here in San Luis Obispo was in 1985, and I was a CDF firefighter on the Cuesta Grade fire. So it was interesting to be back here again. Los Osos is also, I guess I would say, near and dear to Orenco's heart. Orenco was formed 25 years ago over a similar situation that happened in Glide, Oregon. So the origination of Orenco was due to, like I said, a very similar situation that you have right here. And the founders of Orenco, that are Terry Bounds and Hal Ball, got together. They researched all of this technology that you're gonna hear about tonight. And through those 25 years, we've evolved it and refined it to what it is today. And that system is working awesome today in Glide, Oregon. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Mike Saunders, and he's going to take you through the presentation, tell you a little bit about himself and his experience.
Well, good evening. It's kind of interesting. I've only been with Orenco 2 years, but in my former life, I was a utility engineer in Charlotte County, Florida. And I guess prior to Los Osos and their experience with septic abatement, I think Charlotte County was the most notorious place in the country for dealing with a septic abatement. They started a program in 1990. It failed in 1996, same year that I started with them. And I actually replaced it with an effluent sewer system and fronted almost 6,000 properties before I left there. So I can relate firsthand with you. And all of those cost money. I mean, every time you swerve to miss a deer, it's a little bit of money. Every time you hit a tree, it's a whole lot of money. And I think the easiest way to summarize trying to do a successful septic abatement is try to take a different road where you don't have a lot of deer in the road. And as we go through this, we've thought a lot about how do you structure a program to get there. And we've studied a lot of programs around the country to see what's happening with them. And we've learned a lot about our own technology and how we can fit it into an alternative. So I like to put this up here just to kind of give an example of something that you can put in your mind and way we see it anyway. So why do conventional approaches have problems? Well, there's a whole lot of steps. And certainly, I'm sure if you're following the program here, you're aware of a lot of them. Once you've identified a need, that's only a start. You're hiring consultants. you're soliciting funding. Hopefully you eventually get to permitting and actually get to construction and finally get to connect somebody. And all of these steps involve a whole lot of people and a whole lot of money, and there's a lot of risk. And risk is something that I think is very important to identify in a program. And to really put it into perspective, if you just stop at solicit funding, so many programs spend a whole lot of money because they've identified a need. They get to the point of soliciting funding, and there is none. They're looking for grant money to help with their costs. There is none. They're out of pocket a lot of money. Now they have to pay for those bills, and you're nowhere. You don't have a stick of pipe in the ground. You don't have a solution to your needs. So one of the things we're going to emphasize is our goal here was to simplify this process and make it easier and try to keep the players to get us to from A to B, keep them consistent. So how has a conventional approach worked so far? This is kind of interesting. This is a report card that was prepared by the American Society of Civil Engineers, California Region 9, and they gave the wastewater C+. Now, interestingly, that's a pretty good grade compared to the national average. I think the nationally it was D-.
American Society of Civil Engineers.
And maybe the thing to focus on is at the bottom here, there's a $2.3 billion funding gap just to get to a B. And yet, this being the case, this is still the road we travel. Every time we look at a septic abatement program, this is usually the road that we travel. So, I mean, our goal is to do better than a B, definitely, hopefully an A. So one of the messages we want to give to you is that you're not alone. There's programs around the country, and they're following similar issues. And some of these we've been following, and some of them we're actually involved in to some extent. Florida Keys is a great example. They have a 2010 mandate to implement sewer, and it's probably, I think it went into place around 2000. They are not going to meet it. They're not even close to meeting it. And the road that they went down to is they have a very expensive program. Most of their costs now are in excess of $20,000 a property. And when they embarked on their program, they went looking for grant money to make it work. They realized that their affordability in their region was under $5,000 per customer. Well, that meant that they had to find $15,000 a customer in grant money. And they did that for a few projects. They found money. They went out and told their customers it would be $5,000. Well, the problem is there wasn't enough grant money to implement a successful program to meet the 2010 deadline. Now they can't sell a $20,000 program, which is the actual cost. Charlotte County, Florida is the one that I'm right now, about 130,000 people. But when you fill an auditorium with 3,000 or 4,000 people, it gets pretty ugly. And that's what they had. So the local commission was electing three new officials. They ran on anti-sewer platforms. When they got elected, they killed the program. $22 million engineering pretty much out the window. That's when I started there. I started there in 1996 with the county in violation of their comp plan, trying to figure out a solution. The interesting thing about Charlotte County is it's, I believe, the oldest effluent sewer system in the country, probably the world. They actually invented it there. The first systems went in 1974. Today they front in excess of 6,000, they serve in excess of 6,000 properties, front more than 30,000 with effluent sewer, and they have gravity as well. So we used effluent sewer to meet the needs of the comprehensive plan, and say we did 13 areas before I left. And we reduced the cost down from the original cost to a turnkey program that was under $5,000 at that time, installed on the property. And we did it without assessments. And we didn't raise rates. So that was an interesting one. Sarasota County is another project that's now 2 years behind schedule, trying to address 14,000 septic systems. Cape Coral, Florida. It's interesting. This one's in my backyard, and I read about Los Osos on their blog site. So if you're interested, actually, if you want to see some parallels, go visit their newspaper. It's the Fort Myers News Press. They have a whole section dedicated to their sewer program. And they talk about all the problems they're having. They've done half their program. They got sued by all of their contractors. They decided to go another route the second time with a builder at risk type program, and now their costs have jumped from, I think, $14,000 to $23,000. And people are getting a little upset there. So good news is you're not alone. So what's Aranco's vision? And this is our vision, is to make the world a better place by providing appropriate water and wastewater solutions through innovative science-based technologies. And we're kind of proud of this. There's a lot of companies in the wastewater business that sell products. And there's some good products and there's some bad products. And we've never really seen ourselves that way. We're founded by engineers. And you can see that our product line and the way our company's evolved, it's all about going into difficult situations and coming up with a solution. And that is the way our company's built. So who are we today? We are now a globally distributed company. We've been in business for 25 years. So it's pretty important. There's a lot of new players in this business. Aranco is one of the longest and most established. We have more than 270 employees now. And again, we specialize in complete wastewater solutions. Towards that goal, we don't just make effluent sewers. While we're going to focus on that a lot today, we make the tanks for effluent sewers. We make wastewater treatment that we're going to touch on a little bit today. We make on-site treatment systems. We make community collection systems. We make monitoring and control systems. And again, our whole product line is based around having a turnkey solution to a problem. So while we're going to focus on one of those technologies, and a small diameter pressure main in the street. We actually have two options, though. This is STEP stands for Septic Tank Effluent Pumping System. You also have a Septic Tank Effluent Gravity System. And when you have a topography like you have here with some hills to take advantage of, some of the systems actually don't have pumps in them at all. And we'll give you an overall cost savings. At this time, we can't comment how many that would be, but it's important to recognize that there is a mix of systems. And for those that have read, I guess, the Ripley report, that is based on all of them being STEP systems. So I think that's a good thing. I think you want to start at a higher cost and work backwards. But so what are the major components? You can see the tank there to the left. But as you look at the pictures, you can see the top left picture of the components there is our biotube. Actually, it's our drop-in pump chamber, sorry. And what this does is it houses our pump, and it houses our filter for protecting the pump. And it simply just drops into the tank. It has inlets on the side of the chamber that allows the flow into the filter area. And then you see in the bottom right-hand corner is a filter with 1/8-inch openings on it. And what we want to do here is keep that pump protected. We want that pump to last as economically as long as possible. For a pump, we use, if you have a well, it's very similar. It's a multi-stage well pump, except it's been beefed up for a wastewater application. And the reason we standardize on that is it's a proven technology that lasts. This pump will last you 20 to 25 years in normal usage. So when we start talking about the economics of these systems, for those that are familiar, say, with a grinder pump will cost you a couple $1,000s and maybe get you 10 years of service. So if you think about what that costs on an annualized basis, it's quite a bit. Now, if you have a pump like this that's right now is listed for just under $500 and gives you 20 or 25 years service, makes it much more economical. In the lower left-hand corner, you'll see a computer screen. Something else that we do that I don't believe anybody else does is we also provide monitoring at each individual installation. And an operator can go and look at that through any internet-based browser. So as an operator, you can see what's going on in the system. I don't think there's too many collection systems that you can actually go out there and see what's happening in your system like that. So now we're going to start getting into some of the comparisons, just to give you a real idea of the benefits and some of the reasons why these systems do work. So these are just the topics that we're going to look at as we go through. First one we're going to start with is functionality. And want to focus on that interceptor tank, because when you first look at it, if you're used to septic systems, your conclusion might be, well, it's a liability. Why would you put a tank there? Why would you want to create something that you're going to have to pump sludge out of 10 years? Well, we want to look at the big picture of it. The first thing we want to really point out here is that's free treatment. When you look at a typical wastewater system, where be it gravity sewer or grinder pumps, where you're pumping wastewater to a centralized location for treatment, that's full-strength wastewater. It's going to cost X amount of dollars to treat. By providing a tank up front, we're actually providing primary treatment of our wastewater. What that means is on the backside, we can treat it much cheaper, and we can use alternative technologies for treatment. So we like to call it free treatment. There's no energy going into it. We're creating a retention significant. And saying encourage you to go on the internet and just study biosolids a little bit and see how big an issue that has become. And anything you can do to reduce that quantity down in a cost-effective manner is a big benefit. I mean, the answer so far in most communities is to upgrade the level that you treat biosolids to. Well, there's a cost to that, a big cost. If you were just land applying, the cost of handling those biosolids is typically around a third of your treatment cost. Well, that could easily escalate to half your treatment cost if you were upgrading to a higher level of treatment. So, again, there's a big payback for this tank there. And then we create a whole lot of efficiencies when it comes to pumping and conveyance. When you're dealing with raw wastewater, there's certain concerns you have to have as your pump, even if you're putting it through a pressure pipe or even in the gravity system, is that the solids within that flow always want to settle out. Just like in a stream where sediments want to settle, well, the same thing happens in a wastewater stream. And by settling those solids out before we actually put it into the conveyance system, it gives us a lot of flexibility on how we deal with that wastewater flow. So if you wanted to look at a site outside the community, whereas in a conventional system you might need one or two lift stations to pump it fast enough to keep those sediments moving, we don't have to worry about that. We can pump huge distances in any size pipe because we don't have sediments to settle out in the flow. So it gives you complete flexibility. And we talk about the pumps. Pump longevity, this is key to pump longevity. I mean, you can imagine a pump in a harsh environment pumping a lot of solids isn't going to last as long as a pump that's in an environment that doesn't have solids in it. Also, emergency storage volume. It was interesting the other day, I kind of went through just kind of comparing against a conventional system as far as how much system storage. Because we hear that a lot, is in a conventional system, you've got a gravity sewer system that if my power goes out, can hold the flow, and then it goes to a pump station and eventually to the treatment. Well, the reality is in a lot of conventional systems, while the gravity system has some storage, if the power outage happens to happen at a peak flow time, you may only have 15, 20, maybe an hour time to respond before you have a spill. These systems, each one of these tanks is only getting 200 gallons a day, and that's including laundry. If you've got a power outage, you're not doing laundry, you have upwards to 4 days of storage volume in it. So you have a legitimately long period of time before you'd ever have to worry about it. And as a customer that's using this type of system, you educate yourself. You realize that you're not going to do anything that's going to put a lot of water in it. So it makes you accountable.
You're going to tell them about Hurricane Charlie, right?
Yeah. one of my biggest reasons coming on board with Orenco was Hurricane Charlie. I actually went through it. I was in the eye of Hurricane Charlie, and we had over 6,000 of these systems in place. So I got to experience what these systems are like, we were like about 3 or 4 days before we started to see an issue. And you can pump them down with a standard generator. In our case, FEMA pays for generators, so a lot of people were just wiring them into their home generator. Orenco now provides it with a plug that you can flip out and plug a standard generator and pump it down. And since we don't have any lift stations in between, if you put a generator on, pump it down, it's going to pump right to the treatment plant. And allows for lower cost treatment alternatives, and we're going to get into that in a lot more detail in a few more minutes. And it eliminates lift stations. I think the conventional approach had 15 lift stations planned, and is everybody familiar with what a lift station looks like? As it goes down a gravity sewer system, eventually you have to do something. You're going to reach a depth that it's not economical to keep digging, and at that point you have to put in a well to collect your wastewater. We measure it in BOD, which is biological oxygen demand, TSS, total suspended solids, and FOG is oils and greases. And as mentioned in our system, we're going to provide pretreatment in the tank. So we're looking at typical values of 140 milligrams per liter BOD, 30 milligrams per liter TSS, 20 milligrams per liter oils and grease. If you look at a conventional gravity system, you'll see that correspondingly it's 187, 209, and 68. There's an important thing to understand here, though, that these typical rates are largely due to dilution. It's actually much higher than that in a raw wastewater. But one of the things in a gravity system is they're not watertight. During rain events, you're going to get inflow of water into manholes. Long-term, you are going to get pipes that either leak wastewater in or leak them out. If you go look at a 40- or 50-year-old gravity system, that's what's in there. So in a pressurized system, you don't have that issue. In a pressurized system, you can't have infiltration. So when you look at the flow rate, you'll notice that we're actually using a lower flow rate in our design because we don't have to design for infiltration. The collection mains, Big difference. A gravity system, you're looking at pipes probably, you start to lose your economics at around 12 feet deep. So a gravity system will typically have 8-inch diameter pipes. In this type of size community, maybe up to as large as 12-inch. They're going to be as deep as 12 feet deep. Collection mains for our systems are typically are 4 inches or less. Very small diameter. They're typically only buried 3 feet deep. So we're not ripping up roads. And then because they're pressurized, you have total flexibility on how you route these pipes. If when you're in an existing neighborhood, one of your biggest challenges is to identify all the obstacles as you're trying to lay a pipe. There's existing utilities that other utilities don't know are there. You're going to have drainage structures that you got to get around. And you're going to spend a lot of time identifying those structures. Well, if you have a pressurized pipe, small diameter pressurized pipe, if you come up against an old telecommunication cable you didn't know was there, well, we can simply deflect the pipe under over, and there's no increase in cost to deal with that. And functionally, it's not going to change anything. You can loop it just like a water main. They loop water mains for redundancy, that if you ever had a problem with your line somewhere, you can use valves and reroute it another way. Because it's pressurized, you can do that with these systems. Again, no manholes, no INI, which is inflow and infiltration, which is a huge one. The cost of INI, you won't see in a whole lot of engineering reports, it's huge. Not only do you have to treat that water, you have to build capacity in your plant. So typical cost to, construction cost for a treatment plant, let's say, may be as high as $20, $30 for every gallon you build in a treatment plant. So try to imagine if 20 or 30% of your flow is INI. How much extra plant you're building, how much extra flow you're treating, and what that costs. And again, we carry partially treated wastewater. It's not raw sewage. So even in the event that you had, let's say, a contractor was digging and broke a line, you're not spilling raw sewage onto the ground. It's partially treated effluent. So it's not the same thing. And we can follow the topography. You have a rolling topography here. We actually follow the contour of the land. It's not a factor. And conventional sewer, as I mentioned, deep excavation. General rule of thumb, for every foot deep you're going, think about going 2 feet wide. So if you had a 10-foot excavation going down the middle of the road, you're looking at a 20-foot wide excavation. So deeper than 30 feet. So we're talking huge holes. And if you make a design error, it's going to cost. If you are running a line that's grade critical and you run up against an obstacle, that contractor stopped. You're going to be paying for that contractor to sit there and wait for a design change, and you're going to be paying an engineer to probably redesign it. I mean, it's everything is very critical, and you're going to spend a lot of money up front. So what does it look like? This is a typical conventional sewer construction. You can see it's big construction. So when you're constructing an effluent sewer, mentioned that the neat thing is trenchless technology can be utilized extensively at a reasonable cost. And I'm going to show you a picture of what that looks like. But it's kind of neat. You can put pipe down a right-of-way, and if you've got an area that has driveways that you don't want to cut or roadways that you don't want to cut, you can use trenchless technology and actually do it without any cuts at all. We can make field changes basically on the fly without any issues. Existing utilities, landscape driveways, and whatnot can be avoided. Road closures are avoided. Rapid construction. I mean, just throw common sense at this. I mean, if you're putting a pipe 3 feet in the ground, 4-inch diameter, versus putting an 8-inch diameter pipe 12 feet in the ground, we're going to speed up that construction time probably by a factor of 3 at least. We can install pipe real rapidly. And quality control isn't going to be as critical because a lot of the quality control can actually be done at the end of a project. So we're talking about the trenchless technology. I don't know if you've seen these before. Directional boring is used heavily in telecommunications. Very applicable to what we do as well. And the way this works, and for small diameter pipe, when you add up the cost of cutting a trench to put a pipe in and then restoring a road or a driveway, it's usually about a wash as far as cost to do directional boring. And what directional boring is, it's almost like drilling a well vertically, except you're drilling it horizontally, and you can steer the head of your drilling rods. So you will launch from a set point on the right-of-way. The project we did, we typically went about 400 feet at a time. The rod exits at 400 feet, and then you pull the pipe back through the hole that you drilled. So there's no cuts. All you have is a pit every 400 feet. So it avoids, when you look at some of the places in your right-of-way where there is no room, rather than ripping up a road, we if you have trees that you don't want to disturb, we can go right through the root matter without causing a whole lot of problems. You're not going to cut any roads. It's a huge, huge cost savings. So our initial cost for collection mains is typically around 15 to 20% that of gravity sewer. And our total costs, including our on-site costs, are typically in the range of 50 to 80% of gravity sewer in this type of application. So we're going to kind of move into how these cost structures look a little different now, because they create opportunities for different implementation. This is what's going to matter to you, is how would we implement a program that would look a little different? And if we do implement it differently, one of the benefits is that we can start looking at different ways of funding it, or at least doing less funding. So the easiest way to explain it is we break it into four components. And we find that's an easy way to kind of compare how the costs become applicable. So the first component is our on-lot component. And our on-lot is our equipment and piping installed at each property that transports that wastewater to the property boundary. So you saw that first picture of the tank and the pump. That would be our on-lot component. The collection system is the network of piping now that we break it into the components, because you need to understand when those costs become applicable. And the key here is that purple bar, the on-site portion, well, you don't have to build that right away. That cost doesn't become applicable until you connect a house. So one of the things that we kind of preach is, well, the most critical element of septic abatement is at least get the lines in the ground first at a reasonable cost. Well, you see that our cheapest cost is going to be our collection component. Nobody can touch us on the collection component, which is at the bottom of the... And the other thing we show here is actually in this one we show transmission, which would be from a lift station, say, to that I talked about, from a gravity system, a lift station going to a treatment plant. One of the things we're going to talk about is we actually do distributed treatment so that we get rid of that cost completely. We actually treat in neighborhoods and get rid of the treated effluent within neighborhoods to avoid that cost altogether. But the biggest thing is look at it more as a pay me now, pay me later type scheme. What are the costs are going to be that are applicable up front? In this case, we're showing the collection and the treatment, but we're saying that the cost at the time of connection is deferred. And you'll see a lot of analysis done on conventional systems where they don't even talk about their on-site cost. If you have a gravity system, there's still a cost to have a plumber abandon your septic tank, connect in from the home to the street. That cost can be anywhere, I've heard, from $1,000 to $3,000, and yet it's never in an analysis. It's never a factor of the decision-making, but it is there. But the thing to take away from this is that initial cost for a conventional system is going to be far, far higher than anything that we're looking at. I know that time is certainly a concern to everybody in this county, and I mentioned that our construction, because it's much simpler, is going to progress, is much quicker. So not only are we creating this cost benefit, our time to completion is going to be much less from the time you start laying pipe. I think here we're showing it probably about a third. And then we show the on-site construction, which can be, in some programs, here it sounds like it has to be fairly rapid, but we have some where on-site construction, I mean, while you may get a lot of failed septics come in early and get connected, some of them people don't connect for 5 or 10 years until their septic system fails. Because it's, you know, if your septic system is functioning properly, a good argument is, well, why am I a priority versus my neighbor that it's completely failed? And we can provide that kind of flexibility because at least the line is in. It's available, and when the health department inspects a septic system and finds it's not functioning, it gives you an option. So it creates that flexibility on the tail end. So why is this all important now? It's kind of interesting that this doesn't come up a whole lot, but the EPA has done a whole lot of white papers on what affordability is, and I've taken the time to read many of them. But essentially, they define affordability for sewers around 2% of the MHI, which is the median household income. And it's amazing when you start looking at programs, because I've looked at some and went, wow, how is this not? I mean, Marco Island, Florida has a median household income probably approaching $70,000, and yet they have a public revolt there. Well, it's because they have a $30,000 program. It still didn't meet this test. So our question is, we started looking at is, well, can we get to that level? Because obviously if we can't, we're not really achieving anything. So our cost model that we just talked about opens up opportunities. And if we can think out of the box and structure a program around this goal of 2%. Now, so the interesting thing is we started crunching numbers. That was our goal, is we said, well, $100 should be a target here. And this would include financing and everything. So, O&M costs. When a lot of analysis, when they look at options for septic abatement, tend to focus purely on the cost of the collection system. And I will tell you, I've read hundreds of reports where they've compared step and grinder systems to gravity system, and all they talk about is the cost for 20 years of that gravity system. That's all they're going to look at is 20 years. Well, gravity systems actually run very efficiently for 20 years. I mean, there's the I&I that I talked about hasn't started yet to any great extent. The integrity of the pipes is in pretty good shape. So you'll see numbers out there that they quote anywhere from $25 to, say, $60 a year to maintain that gravity system. So then they look at ours and go, that's $100 a year. You've got to maintain a tank. You've got to maintain a pump. Well, if that's all you want to base it on, yeah, you're probably saying gravity looks okay. But I've already mentioned to you that we reduce treatment costs, we reduce I&I, we reduce biosolids. So I guess my goal now to you is not only to demonstrate that we provide better value than gravity sewer, but that maybe we can get down to that $100 number. So here's the first thing I want to point out, is if you actually chart all of your O&M costs, gravity against step, again, what they're going to be comparing is in the yellow at the bottom of the middle chart for gravity, they're going to be focusing on that collection cost, saying we are the best collection alternative. And they're going to look at ours at the left and say, well, your on-lock costs and your collection costs are much higher than ours. Well, one of the things I'm going to say is we offer up a treatment alternative that may be as little as a third of your treatment cost from a conventional system. Going to make all that money back. Going to make it back on the treatment side. And one of the things that we really talk about a lot is that we do an integrated system. Part of our treatment is in our collection system. So part of our typical O&M cost for the on-sites at being $100 a year is actually part of your treatment cost again. I'm saving it on the backside. So we set up a net present value analysis. And what a net present value, the easiest way to compare competing technologies is to look at it in what we call as an NPV, net present value analysis. And essentially what that means is we want to know how much money we need in a pot today to cover our costs over a time certain. And it's the easiest way to compare different, you know, if you're comparing apples against oranges, the easiest way is to bring all those costs to the same day and see what's cheaper. So we've done this for this community. We've looked at it and make sure that this is a market that we should consider. I mean, we had to answer that our question, or we had to answer that question to ourselves before we could come here today. And this was interesting. In the gravity sewer example, in a 20-year net present value, so now this is, again, how much money do you need in a pot today to pay for all your O&M costs for 20 years? This is what it looked like. You needed $7.9 million approximately for O&M. You needed $22 million for treatment. Well, it's interesting. If we're only focusing on the $7.9 million, we're only focusing on 26% of the real cost. And if we're basing our decision on that, are we doing this right? So this is why I say focus on the treatment. If that's 74% of our cost, so one of the things we do a lot when we're trying to figure out where we stand is we extend our analysis out to 60 years. And there's some significance to why we would look at it as 60 years. I mentioned lift stations. Well, lift stations need to be rehabilitated 20, 25 years. But gravity sewers start to degrade at around 50 years. I&I starts to increase. They need to be addressed. If you're only analyzing at 20 years, you're not capturing those significant costs that are occurring at 50 and 60 years. So we extend the analysis out to 60 years. And now this is what our O&M expense looks like again. So now this is our pot, again, that we're creating to how much money will it take to cover those expenses for 60 years. Well, the interesting thing is you'll see that R&R, our renewal and replacement, has suddenly occurred. It wasn't in the 20-year analysis. It is now because we're starting to replace components in that gravity sewer system. Not only has it materialized, it's as big a cost as all of our operation and maintenance costs up to over those 60 years. It's pretty significant, and yet most analysis don't consider that cost as part of their decision-making. Well, it tells me you should. You should extend your analysis out to 50 or 60 years and make sure you capture all costs. And again, the treatment here is still 55% of the total cost. If you could save 50, 60% of that, it's very worthy. So something that's, and you probably got it a little bit from the pie chart, but one of the things that's very interesting is that if you can now compare your 20-year analysis and a 60-year analysis, if you just purely look at a 20-year analysis, you're going to see that the gap in cost is very small between all the different technologies. Essentially, that allows you, I mean, you can go in there and change two numbers that make up that equation, and you can change the outcome. What happens over time, though, is what you're going to see in the step system is it's a very manageable system. It's all components that get replaced as part of your operations and maintenance. The system stays very close to an as-new condition if you're operating it properly. Gravity systems degrade, and they're going to degrade for a long time, and that gap's going to widen, widen, widen. And you see that. One of the things, if you want to test this, go back to your computer tonight or tomorrow, and in Google sewer rate increase, and see how many of those are attributed to infrastructure that is degraded to the point they have to spend money on it. Almost all of them. And we're talking big rate increases, and a lot of them are open-ended. They don't know when it's going to end. This is it's happening all over the country. And it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. If you have infrastructure buried under the ground, if you live in a neighborhood that has gravity sewer, there's nobody in that neighborhood that's going to be able to tell you what condition that gravity sewer is. In fact, the utility may not even know until one day something catastrophic happens and somebody says, you need to do something about it. So critical considerations. Consultants typically try to compare wastewater collection technologies based on short-term analysis, 20 years, and without consideration of the total cost. So we want to say you want to use total cost. Step systems are a ticket to saving 30 to 70% on the treatment side. Treatment cost is the biggest opportunity to save operations and maintenance cost. So we always like to talk a little bit about the equipment, too, especially in systems that are not, I mean, a 6,000 customer system is not a big utility system by any measure. And it's really important to acknowledge what type of equipment you need to maintain different types of systems. $1,000 and fairly short life cycles. You're probably replacing these every 5 or 6 years. They take a beating. Your 15 lift stations, you need a boom truck. They're running around $60,000 right now, and you need that to lift the pumps out of the wet wells. You may need a dump truck and a backhoe so that you can dig deeper. These are big costs, and if you got 6,000 customers, think about buying a $250,000 piece of equipment every 5 or 6 years, and the maintenance costs in between. It's significant. You don't see a lot of that in a lot of analysis. Again, just a pickup truck and tools. Sustainability. One of the things that we hear thrown out a lot is that it's not a real system. They're temporary systems, not proven. Well, step systems have been around for more than 30 years. Pretty good track history on them now. Aranco's been manufacturing them for 25 years. So what that means is we've already gone through that first renewal and replacement cycle on all the elements that are in that on-site unit. It's been around. We know how long these things are lasting. Properly maintained step systems with more than 20 years of history exist today without any notable cost adjustments due to aging. They're out there. Step systems are modular, and what that means is, as part of our operations and maintenance costs, you're doing a lot of your renewal and replacement. We don't have, to put in perspective, we might be replacing a pump at 25 years. A gravity system, you're out there replacing manholes at 50 years. You're digging streets back up. You're sending people down in there to do work in the middle of these manholes where you're trying to handle wastewater flow. There's a big contrast in the effort that it takes. Today, there is estimated more than 150,000 step units in service, and they're found in almost every state. Pardon me? How many of your systems are in California?
It's upwards of 30 or 40.
And that's complete. That's not individual units.
Those are
community systems.
Community systems.
And this is just a graphic that we are across the country. Renewal and replacement costs. General rule of thumb, and this applies to a lot of infrastructure, is that for every dollar you're going to spend on initial capital cost, eventually you're going to spend $1.50 for renewal and replacement. Renewal and replacement costs more than new construction. So if you apply that logic, it makes a whole lot of sense to reduce your capital cost up front. Lower capital costs will yield lower long-term renewal and replacement costs. And it's interesting, there's been a lot of studies written about this now, about, I think there, I read one probably last year that was talking about the country going bankrupt because of the cost of renewal and replacement of its infrastructure. It's a huge number. Think about roads, bridges. Think about, I mean, it's staggering. Lift stations, mentioning, and there's 15. These are huge renewal and replacement items. If you have 15 stations, you're looking at a reoccurring cost of about $2 million every 20 to 25 years. And the logistics. And one of the biggest things is, how do you deal with, if you got big pipe, dealing, you know, it's one thing to actually physically do the work, but the logistics of doing that work sometimes costs more than the physical work. If you have a lift station, you can't do it while you have flow in that lift station. You have to set up pumps. You have to bypass it. The cost of bypassing a lift station while you rehabilitate it can be huge, and it's high risk. If a pump fails, you've got sewage in the streets. This statement is made, if you looked at this community, you go, wow, you got 5,000-6,000 tanks out there. It does sound pretty enormous, but I think you have to put it in perspective. Each one of these tanks is receiving 200 gallons of flow a day. So even in the worst case scenario, even though there's alarms to tell you if the system fails, let's say you actually had a spill. Well, at the rate that it comes out of a single household, you're probably looking at, what, 20 or 30 gallons before you could address the problem? I mean, I think ticking time bomb's a little off the chart. Beyond that, Orenco takes an active role in assuring quality products. We do not let any tank be used. We manufacture tanks. And if it's a third-party tank that you're using, we certify that tank for being used because we don't want the system to fail. And then we also use telemetry to monitor these systems. So in the event that something fails in that system, be it a pump or a control mechanism, a couple things are going to happen. If we have it on telemetry, it's going to dial in to our computer and let us know, and we have a notification process back to the utility. It'll automatically notify them through a pager or to their desktop. And then if that's not cleared, they have to go in there and physically say, yeah, we've responded to this. If they don't, then it notifies a second person. If they don't respond, it notifies a third person. And if nobody has gone in there to respond to this, then there's a time certain when it's going to go to a local alarm, because this will all happen before a resident even knows. And if the utility's never responded, at some point, your alarm's going to go off locally. You're going to get a light, you're going to get a horn, and then you're going to know. And then you can bother the utility. And a good utility, you're never going to get to that point. But there's all these safeguards to happen before you ever get to a point that it would ever spill. The other thing that this telemetry is going to offer is that if you did have a leaking tank, if you had water coming in or sewer going out, the monitoring system is actually going to pick that up and tell you. So there's no other system like this where you can monitor every single installation at the point of discharge. You can't, I mean, it just doesn't happen. So has anybody ever seen a septic tank do this? This is a manhole. And you know what? It looks crazy, and yeah, we pull a crazy picture in here to demonstrate, but the reality is, if you talk to most utility operators or gravity systems, they have some of these in their system. I had one in my system we eventually were able to fix, but we had one where in a huge rain event, we blew the top off the manhole. We just couldn't deal with the water that was coming into it. So I wonder in a break, like even a small break, one of the things you're not going to see in a gravity system is you may not be able to detect it, number one. So it could go for, I mean, you read some of these and you read the spill reports, they don't know when it started. So if you had a 100-gallon, let's say a 5-gallon-a-minute break, and it went on for 2 or 3 weeks. Well, what does that add up to? Or if it's on a major pipe that's handling 1,000 homes, during peak flow, you may have 500 gallons a minute coming through that line. Well, how big is that break? I mean, there was one in Hawaii that was in the millions.
I mean, they have them down here on the beaches.
So where are the opportunities for environmental risk? Well, lift stations, I mentioned a lot of those will go into alarm, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, maybe an hour. Your response time's pretty tight. And many of these, the smallest lift stations are handling peak flows of 100 gallons a minute. So if you've got 100 gallons a minute coming in and you don't respond in 15 minutes, that's a lot of flow coming out. Exfiltration, we talked, every customer has their own tank. So if somebody dumps into their tank, you can go back there, take samples, and you'll find it. And you'll find residual in that tank, and you can hold them responsible. And they can't argue it. They're the only ones connected to that tank. Something that, you know, we didn't talk a lot about 10 years ago even, but it's pretty real today, is terrorist threats. gravity sewer systems, once in a while you hear people actually talk about it, they're very susceptible to a terrorist threat. They're accessible anywhere in the system, and the amount of damage that you can cause is catastrophic. While this picture wasn't caused by a terrorist, this was in 1981. This was in Louisville. There was a solvent in the sewer that exploded. Look what it did. Now try to imagine. I mean, this is a conduit underneath cities. What could happen? It's a little bit mind-boggling. Electrical consumption. I know that the consultant here did one of the best jobs I've ever seen of actually studying electrical consumption, because there's also a lot of innocent people say, well, you got 6,000 pumps, you're burning a lot of electricity. Well, these pumps will only burn, I mean, will only use, I guess can't quote California rates, but probably even here, maybe $15 a year in power in a year. I mean, they're very low power users. I mean, they only cycle when the flow gets up to a certain level. When you compare that to what, you know, conventional, everybody has this mindset that conventional applications don't use electricity. Well, the gravity sewer may not, but when you get to that lift station has not half horsepower pumps, they got 20 horsepower pumps running continuously, eating up a lot of power. And then that system will pump over to another lift station and repump and burn up more power. And you may go through two or three lift stations before you get to the point of treatment. And then when you get to the point of treatment, then you're burning up more power because you're treating a higher strength wastewater. You have blowers running longer. You may have more chemical addition. You're going to burn up more energy in handling your sludge because the sludge is a higher quantity. So I think one of the things that the consultant working for the district here discovered is, hey, STEP's going to use less energy overall. We're not going to talk a lot about the treatment because, well, frankly, the evaluation recommended a different technology, but I'll just introduce you to what we do because we actually matched it up with this collection technology. We, in 2000, we patented a textile treatment system, and it's kind of interesting. If you're familiar with sand and gravel filters, some of the weaknesses, and while those systems have been around forever, some of the weaknesses is that it was difficult to build them with a high level of quality, and they required a large amount of surface area to provide treatment. And we built the system off that concept and made it modular. And the concept here is each one of these pods treats 5,000 gallons a day, peak flow. And essentially to provide treatment, we assemble these pods in as many as we need to provide whatever level of treatment we need. So if you needed 20,000 gallons of treatment, we would put four pods together. If you needed 100,000, we'd add whatever we need. And the other thing that's kind of interesting is we don't need to put all our treatment in one place. The concept's always that you centralize your treatment. We actually talk about distributing our treatment. And the concept is that if you have four or five, one of the things you'll notice is there's no moving parts, there's no chemical addition. So when we talk about making our money back on the treatment side, nobody can really touch us as far as what we treat a gallon or 1,000 gallons of wastewater for with this technology. So we take advantage of that front-end collection system. So it's quite a different concept, and again, it's if we were looking at this type of application where you may have five or six sites around the city where you actually treat wastewater. So now, with all this said, and hopefully I haven't lost too many to this point, so what is the opportunity? Well, our opportunity is to reduce the initial capital cost. What that means is less need for government assistance or possibly no need at all. So how big a deal is that? Well, unfortunately, there's a lot of strings attached to a lot of government assistance, and a lot of those strings cost money. So it's not the most efficient process in a lot of applications. What we propose to do is we've assembled a program where we actually utilize private financing. Okay, so there is no public money. That this money actually comes from a private partnership. So not only do we provide the solution, we provide the financing, and then we can offer different ways of how we make our financial partner happy. We're going to shorten the time for engineering, permitting, and construction. The engineering is very simple because it's low risk. I mentioned the fact that if there's a design problem, you can adjust in the field without a cost. So that means you don't have to spend as much time up front avoiding those issues. Construction time, we've already talked about that. We lower that risk. We talked about all those deer in the roads. Well, we get rid of those. I mean, we want to make this process as streamlined as possible, so lower that risk. If you're using grant money, I've said don't. If you've got access to grant money, it's okay to use it, but use it in a different way. Do not use it on the front end. Don't use it for the collection. Don't use it for the treatment, because that will slow down that process. Where you can use it is once you get those lines in the ground, use it to make connections. And I know we've seen it in many of the communities where they're using CDBG money as a home improvement. They're paying a portion of that on-site cost. And there's grant processes that some communities have been able to establish under those programs. And some of them are loans that aren't paid off until you sell the home. So it gives you a whole lot more opportunity on how you're going to deal with that money in a more efficient manner. So, again, focus on getting the pipe in the ground. This was actually the way I set up the program that I administered. It was a lot different, and I don't know that it would work here, but it just goes, I want to put this in just to show you the flexibility. I was able to, in Charlotte County, take advantage, because I said right off the bat is I didn't do assessments. There was no assessments. We didn't borrow any money. What we did is we set up a revolving fund. We had $2 million that we achieved through reducing our budget. And at the end of the year, we went to our elected officials and said, well, here's what we want to do with our $2 million. We don't want to use it to pay off our debt and reduce our debt. We actually want to invest it in our system. And we used it as seed money and started putting pipe in the ground. And we actually had a connection fee that residents paid once those pipes were in the ground that mirrored our cost. And as people connected, they paid this connection fee, put it back into our revolving fund, and we put more pipe in the ground. And we just kept this revolving, and we never assessed. And it worked. So the point there is there's you can really think out of the box, because you can take it to the initial financing so that people that sign up early, we could have the main contractor put it in at probably a reduced cost and longer-term financing. So there's a whole lot of flexibility once you get the pipe in the ground. So what does this program hopefully look like? And this is more our recommendation than anything. And this is based on our observations here and throughout the country. We firmly believe that the best solution is to go RFP, and what that stands for is a request for proposals. Because we're not here to say we're going to go meet with somebody here and get a contract by the end of the day. That's not our goal. Our goal is to educate here and encourage you to open the door to competition. We're ready to step forward. We'll answer an RFP. We'll bring a team in here. We'll provide a complete solution. And what we would recommend is not only in a typical process, you hire a consultant to do design. We're saying expand that RFP. Do it as a design, build, finance. And the key to this is you're going to have a team that understands their goals and comes back to this community with a solution to attain those goals. And you can write this RFP to define those goals. You can define all of the impediments that you think are there that the team has to be able to address. I mean, we don't know them all sitting here today. We haven't spent enough time studying them. But if the RFP said there's a problem here and we're not sure how you're going to address it, then at least when we're forming our team, we're going to go find somebody that hopefully can put together a solution for that problem and put it in our proposal. And then you can establish what you think your deliverables will be. So what does this mean? When we talked about our MHI, or median household income, your stated goal can be that you got to be at 2% or 2.5%. I mean, we may say 2% is unattainable, but we can get to 2.5%. But anybody that's coming in at 10%, at least I don't think they're going to rate very well, will they? Now, so if you're going through a conventional approach where a consultant's designing something and then coming back to you with the cost, well, you've already paid him for a design or an analysis, then you can't turn back. You already know you're at 10% of that MHI. And I'm saying through this process, I think you can define that. So then what would we do as a team? Well, we make a proposal for a complete solution. Not part of a solution, not just a step in the solution, a complete solution. And what would be the responsibility of the district or whoever's evaluating? They'd establish a committee and they would rank these proposals. Now, we would hope we would win. There may be other groups out there that can, offer something better than we can. I don't know. I mean, we're pretty confident we've spent a lot of time and that we feel pretty good about where we think we can go with this. But fact is, the decision will reside here. And as I said, our team would include engineers. It would include the material suppliers. Obviously, we're them. Financial partners and a contractor. And you think about, well, what's kind of neat about this? Well, the financial partner is going to hold us accountable directly because they're part of the team. we can negotiate with our contractors. If we've got a contractor in our group that isn't getting the price we need, then we can go to another contractor. We don't have to go low bid. We don't have to, we can go there and negotiate. In fact, we can include that contractor in our design team to make sure that we design it in the best manner to get the best price. It gives us this flexibility to deliver the best product for the best money. The final cost, when all is said and done, your cost shouldn't be an unknown that you find out in 5 years. If you do your RFP process, that RFP, the responder should be able to say, this is what it's going to cost you per month. Because we know what our financials, once you have the program in place, you may have some ordinances to adopt. The reason I have tariff in here is we get asked a lot about public or private property access. Well, in the community I was in, we adopted a service tariff. And what that meant is that we had a blanket tariff that gave us the right to own and operate infrastructure on private property, just like the phones companies do and the power companies do. And essentially, that was the cheapest way for the residents to do it, because if you made an argument saying, well, we have to have an easement on every property, we can do that, but there's a cost to that. You're going to pay for a survey. You're going to have your property rights, you know, described. Whereas a tariff just simply describes what our responsibilities are in recognition that we're going to provide this service. And the responsibilities for both the homeowner and the utility are spelled out. And there is no cost. When you sign a service agreement, you acknowledge and you've read the tariff and the utilities going to meet the needs of those tariffs. And then the system's constructed and connections can start to be made. So I think that when you look at this, what's the most evident thing that's missing here? The risk has gone down. I mean, immensely. There's not as many deer in the road. And hopefully there's no trees. I mean, we can't say that for sure, but I mean, it seems a lot simpler. So we did a little preliminary evaluation just because, again, we were focusing on the $100. And, you know, certainly in this mechanism, we haven't done a full detailed analysis, and we haven't talked extensively to our other team members to make sure that this all meets and lines with them. But in our rough numbers, we were looking at an initial financing of $40 to $50 million for collection and treatment. And we've looked at a couple different models, and we kind of went with the one I think that you're familiar with, that everything is put onto your rates. And that being understood, can we get to a $100 a month rate, including financing all of the infrastructure? So we kind of figured that the cost for $40 to $50 million of collection and treatment infrastructure could be covered in a $45 to $50 surcharge on a monthly bill for 20 years. That would pay, and we feel that that would meet the financial needs of our financial partner. We haven't told him yet, but we'll work on that. The on-site installation, again, there's a lot of flexibility here. What we would envision is that residents can sign up early prior to construction for connections so that we can take advantage of having long-term financing at a cheaper rate. Also, we can take advantage of mass installation, meaning that we're going to be installing thousands of these. The contractor should be able to give us a pretty good price. And we'll pass those savings back along to the customer. So in this mechanism, we think we're looking at about $30 to $40 to cover the on-site cost, again, over 20 years. So we're up to, $70 to $90 in cost per month to pay for the infrastructure, the on-site and the off-site. We would speculate that our O&M costs, probably in the range of $25 to $35 if you're setting money in reserves for any future expenses. So our target range, we think we're in the $100 to $120 range. So, and again, these are very, I mean, we're hoping that these are conservative too. Remember I said there may still be stag connections that reduce cost. There's still opportunity here to get those costs lower. But the key is, I think it worked out to 2.3% of that MHI. So we're in that ballpark. So we felt pretty good about that. At this point, we don't know what it exactly looks like and how it all fits, but the key is I think we feel pretty comfortable that we could get down to a manageable number. So why does this work? Well, no public money is going to equal faster delivery with less strings attached. It places the supplier, the consultants, the contractor, and the financial partner on the same team with a common goal. It establishes a definitive cost before you commit. You can define that goal as 2% of your MHI. And the steps in solution delivery can run concurrently to save time. And what I mean by that is you can actually start construction sometimes before your complete design is done. You can start building in an area on your initial design, start designing phase two or three or however you want to structure it. That we can run, because the team is all together, you can run different processes concurrently. And besides that, we already know what isn't working, so we can build off of that as well. So your current choices, I mean, you can look at a conventional approach, and I think the last study we saw actually had it approaching $350 a month, which I think that would be a record. So I guess the good thing out of that is you'd have a claim to fame. you could do nothing, but as I understand, there'd be a whole lot of consequences attached to doing nothing. Or like I say, what we're trying to assemble is a private sector approach with a design, build, finance. So our ultimate goal is raising the bar for the state report card and trying to attain an A. So with that, hopefully we covered everything, and if you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
We're going to take a 10-minute break, and then we're going to have questions and public comment. Thanks very much.
You guys want some okay. I'm going to get water. Yeah, I'm talked out.
Thank you, everybody. If you could come have a seat, we're going to start our question and answer period, starting with the board. Thank you very much for that presentation. Very informative. We'd like a copy of the PowerPoint to place on our website. And again, this meeting is being streamed, recorded, and archived. And we'll have that there as well, so people can, and we'll be passing this to other people for information. Do we have any questions from the board right now? Do you have any questions, or would you rather hear from the public first? Oh, Director Cecenia?
The idea of tariffs was a whole new thing to me. I mean, that's been one of the objections that I keep hearing about is the time it takes to get easements and record easements and this and that. So the tariffs is an idea that's been used before, obviously.
You know, that they weren't being protected by the tariff as if they would be by an easement. In fact, I think it was less restrictive to the property owner because an easement, if you paid for an easement, it's probably going to tell you you can't do anything in that location. We didn't say that. It simply said we're going to maintain clear access to access the pump, and here's what we're going to do, and that we can't leave that site unless it's the same or better condition than when we arrived.
I guess one of the things that I want to address in respect to the OMLOT is that I think one of the things that Orenco gets criticized for is that one of our requirements is that you do manage what's on lot on the property. And you'll hear our opponents come out and say, well, you don't have to do that with gravity sewer. We would say from an engineering perspective, that's irresponsible. Because you can go out and, as Mike said, Google it or whatever you want. You can go to Seattle Public Utility District and look at some of their INI studies that they've had. In some of the districts, over 90% of their INI come from their connection laterals. And it's very expensive to go back in and try to repair those lateral connections on a gravity sewer. So to not manage what's on lot is truly irresponsible because now you've got the cost of treating INI at the plant. Really, the common practice today is not to fix what's on lot, deal with the INI, and go build a bigger plant.
Well, I think I heard you just say that the property owner then would have some responsibilities for operation or maintenance or taking care of what's on lot. What would you expect that to be?
No, we would recommend that the utility do that.
Okay, that's what
yeah.
I wanted to make sure of, because that's what I'm comfortable with,
yeah.
is making sure that you have a professional.
Absolutely, yeah.
Thanks.
Any other questions at this time? Director Sennett, do you?
Thank you for that presentation. It was very enlightening. I had a question regarding the project development costs. How do you interface with the lead agency in preparing the environmental documentation, getting the permits, discharge permits, and everything like that? How do you package a project like that?
Part of our team is going to include an engineering lead as well. So they're going to be an engineer with a local experience. We understand that that's pertinent to getting the job done. As far as how it's going to go, we really don't know at this point. Until, if you move into an RFP process, that's going to be probably one of the questions you're going to ask of us is how are you going to get through this process and who's going to do it? And we're going to have to define that for you. At this point in the game, it's pretty hard for us to define how that's going to go.
Because those types of institutional and regulatory requirements are part of the cost or time cost in developing the final product. So that's why I was so interested in that. Important to us.
Again, one of the interesting things about an RFP is it's going to force our team to identify those because it'll be a cost to us more than it would be a cost to you. If it's in a conventional engineering contract that you may not have defined within your scope of services or they may have kept...
Oh, retrofits. Mm-hmm. So people had existing tanks. Did most of those tanks need to be replaced for it to fit to make your style tanks?
Well, in the program we did, we actually dropped chambers into most of the existing tanks. Now, in hindsight, I'm not sure that that's the way I would recommend to go. We were combating cost heavily. I mean, that was the biggest issue we were dealing with, and we decreased cost quite a bit by utilizing the existing tanks. But we also understood that as a utility, if that tank failed in 10 years, we were on the hook to replace it. I'm not sure that I would go there again, given the same circumstances. I think for the additional cost, I would actually replace the tank and assure a 50-year life cycle on it.
What kind of resistance did you, if you did encounter resistance from residents about keeping septic tanks on their property? And how did you address it?
What's interesting I don't think the general person that needed service had a real problem with it, but we did have people that really were anti-sewer, didn't matter what the technology was going to be, and they were looking for a way to achieve that goal. And we had some that said, I own that tank, you're not going to use it. In that case, we said, we can accommodate that. The problem is the state's going to make you abandon the tank and collapse it anyway, so for whatever it's worth to you. As far as people having that on their property from an operations perspective, it didn't really matter to them. It was seamless. I mean, it was no different than a gravity connection to them. The utility was owning and operating the tank. If the tank failed structurally, that was going to be replaced by the utility. If a pump needed to be replaced, it was going to be done by the utility. So, and they're being charged the same rate that our gravity connections were. And aesthetically, it wasn't an issue. So we didn't really hear anything.
You didn't have resistance. Is that what you're saying?
Pardon me?
You didn't have much resistance?
Not really, no. And they had been through what the conventional approach was going to look like and what the costs were going to be. So maybe that made it a little easier, too, to make it work.
We just hear resistance in our community, and I think it's just because of they've heard rumors about untested methods and mm-hmm. those kind of things. And in reality, there's plenty of places in this country that are using them. Mm-hmm. Another similarity I read about in Charlotte County was about high groundwater. Is that mm-hmm. true?
Table there is at 4 feet.
Is it 4 feet?
Yeah.
So these tanks were in high groundwater areas.
Yes.
And how did that affect the construction or the installation of this method?
Well, it wasn't a factor at all for the mainline construction, again, because we're burying at 3 feet. So we were actually above the water table, whereas a conventional approach would have been in the water table. The tanks, while we just got into the water a little bit for setting the tanks, what we would do is actually put rock in the bottom of the excavation in the water and set the tank in the water. Because we only had maybe 2 feet of water at the bottom of the excavation. So, again, it wasn't a huge factor. It's a good match for that area just for that reason alone. When I was talking about INI, out of our conventional systems in Charlotte County, we were at 30%.
You were at 30% INI of
on a gravity system,
which means because of that high groundwater, right. Those big pipes would have leaked into the gravity pipes and had to go to the plant to be treated, and it would have cost extra money that nobody was paying for.
Right.
And if it was salt water like it is here, because we have salt water intrusion issues, mm-hmm. not that the salt water isn't always at the gravity level, then we would also pollute. Okay. Then one last question before I open it up to the public. This picture up here is a picture of your treatment plant.
Right. And yeah, we were talking about whether it was clear what a plant looks like in our configuration, because everybody's used to open tankage, and they're not the most, I guess the prettiest installations to look at. This is what our typical treatment plants look like that we team up with this technology. And it's not to say, I know that the report recommended an alternative technology, but we thought we'd bring a picture of what this looks like as well, because the costs are very much in line.
Okay. Okay. Yes, Director Tacker.
Along the lines of treatment, you say you have 27 5,000-gallon pods for the 135,000-gallon design. Mm-hmm. What is the area that the 27 pods would take up?
Typically, for 100,000 gallons of treatment, we can put in about a quarter acre.
Quarter acre?
Yeah.
Okay. So for us, we would multiply that by 10.
And yeah, I mean, you may have some setback requirements and whatnot that confine that space a little bit, but.
Okay. Thank you.
Director Sennett?
Yes. How would you address nitrate rejection for reducing nitrates in the discharge?
It pretty much identically that the other technologies would have to also. I mean, nitrification and denitrification. Nitrification, you're going to be limited by the amount of alkalinity that's coming in to the system for nitrification. Typically, on an effluent sewer, you're going to be your total nitrogen range on the influent is going to be around in the 60 to 70 milligrams per liter. With the carbon source that we have at around 120 to 140 on the biochemical oxygen demand, just with normal recirculation through that system, you're going to see about 50 to 60% removal. So you're going to be down in the 25 to 30 milligram per liter range. We can do a different type of system configuration that can pick up and utilize that carbon source a little bit better, get it down into the 20 milligram per liter range. After that, you're looking at some type of chem feed system that would feed alkalinity and possibly carbon into the system. Now, some people would say, well, you know, the other collection systems, you know, they put all the carbon at the plant, and they also produce all the biosolids at the plant. It's a lot cheaper to add a carbon source at the plant for denitrification purposes because you can actually control it, and you know how much carbon you have to use in order to hit your discharge limits than it is to deal with the cost of biosolids.
And, you know, one of our strategies is to use the nitrogen as a fertilizer source for reclaimed water for irrigation. But beyond that, would this be treating to a tertiary level?
Well, no, because in order to get to tertiary, you'd want to, I mean, you would have to put disinfection on there in order to get to that, in order to get to that type of level. So, and I assume tertiary is 5.
Okay. Now? Thank you. Karen Venditti, Los Osos. One quick question regarding the response you received from the State Water Board in those systems that you've already, that's already been implemented in California. What kind of response have you received from the State Water Board in terms of approving, permitting the systems, the effluent systems?
Can you give me a little bit more detail? I mean, I can answer you this. I know of no problems with any permitting on our effluent sewer systems. Is that kind of what you were looking for?
Somewhat.
Yeah.
We've been told by some officials in the county that it has not been a proven process, the effluent collection system, and that we would have a hard time getting approval because it hasn't been a proven technology.
Okay. Well, we can address those issues specifically with them if they have certain criteria that they're looking at to say that this is a proven technology or isn't a proven technology. But I can tell you that it is in major engineering textbooks, so engineers do study this technology. And as Mike pointed out, it's been around for over 30 years, and we have several hundred installations around the United States. So,
how many in California?
Yeah, well, I think it's upwards of 30 or 40 in California, and some of them are fairly sizable. I mean, I know in Placer County, in the county that I was a regulator in, one of the systems was 1,000 connections, and that was the Winchester subdivision near Auburn, California. And then Saddleback subdivision was another good size one too. That was up in the couple hundred range there. So in the last time I checked in Placer County, I think they had six or eight of eight step systems alone in that county. Amador had like 11, I think, step systems in that county. So I don't have the total in my head, but anyway, sure.
Thank you, Ms. Vendetti. Who else would like to speak? Mr. Moylan?
Hi, my name is Bill Moylan, and I was just wondering, one of the concerns at the Regional Water Quality Control Board here is the nitrates in the groundwater, and the board is also suggested to the water board, I mean the CSD has suggested to the water board that we could do an agricultural swap, but what if there's not enough demand for, you know, the effluent? How did you handle the effluent problems, or the effluent after you collected it in, say, Charlotte? Florida. That's a double-ended question, I guess.
Yeah. I just tell them it's probably not the best.
Yeah, Charlotte County is not the best comparison. It's actually Florida. What they do is they categorize it. You have primary disposal, which is typically they ask you to do reuse where it's economically feasible. And then they do secondary disposal in case it's too wet to use primary, and they pump it 10,000 feet in the ground.
Oh, they pump it down into the ground.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, I mean, throughout the country, we use, we can use any type of disposal that is commonly being used now. I mean, we use drip irrigation throughout the country.
Disposal. And there's a lot of areas of town that we're going to lose trees, we're going to lose a lot of landscaping due to the failure of not having that effluent going into the ground. That would be one question. And a second question would be, as far as what Ripley was able to put on the end of their treatment plant was the septage treatment facility. And in my eyes, we could also help the rest of the county, or at least the coastal area, by maybe taking their septage. There is no place except Santa Maria, and it's got a limit on how much they can take. So when AB 885 goes into effect, there's going to be a problem getting rid of septage throughout this county, and that might be something that would help add a benefit to us by doing that treatment. And I wonder if you could address that as an end.
Thank you.
Purple pipe, were you meaning residential irrigation or just for bulk users? Or
both. Okay.
Schools. You know, typically, if you look at going residential, you typically don't produce enough effluent to meet the demands. So normally it's more cost effective just to focus on the bulk users, and usually they'll take everything you need. So that would be usually limited to golf courses, parks, and we would agree. I mean, actually our whole concept is built on that we're not so much promoting purple pipe, we're actually saying move our treatment closer to your irrigation demands so that you save the cost of, because you know, you're producing wastewater in those areas. Why go across town to treat it and then purple pipe all the way back when you can treat it right there and irrigate on that site?
Tell her about being able to...
Just to add on to that, I know in Cambria there is someone who has installed a huge tank because they have a huge garden. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking for certain areas, that, you know, the installation of a tank that received treated effluent and just held it there and then could gravity feed it to a variety of yards if there were people that were into high-end gardening or something.
Throughout the country, it's become a resource. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's great when a community really steps up to that level and sees it as a resource to offset, you know, other water uses. and it makes a lot of sense. The question is really just, you know, again, how much do you want to spend and how much will it cost? But I think it's important that part of the analysis that would be done is actually to identify all the users and you know, try to balance that in the planning. And again, it's pretty hard to answer that today. I mean, we're not really familiar with it. And the other thing you can do is it typically is cheaper to lay a second pipe as part of, you know, if you're putting a pipe in. And some states have separation requirements. I'm not sure what California's is, but I know in Florida we had a vertical and a horizontal separation, but we could cheat it a little bit by actually putting in a trench that was stepped, because we could create our vertical separation. So we'd have a trench that we'd put in our sewer main, and then we'd step it up a foot, and we'd put our reuse main on a shelf. And we'd actually save a lot of money putting it in that way. And sorry, the second question you had was? You know, it's interesting that somebody's not in the business. In Charlotte County, we recognize that it is actually potential to generate revenue. We added a septic treatment plant on one of our conventional plants. We spent $250,000 building it, and in our first year, we generated $500,000 in income. And we put
Roger Anderson from Morro Bay. I have to apologize, I came in after your presentation had started. I'd been at another meeting. And one of the things that I've experienced myself when I was mayor of Morro Bay, Duke Energy bought the power plant in Morro Bay. They wanted to come in, do something they'd done elsewhere, replace old steam turbines with jet turbines. And I tried to talk to some of the company representatives explaining California's a little different. The coastal zone is even more different. And I was in Washington talking to one of their lobbyists, and the woman actually leaned across the table, patted my hand, and said, "Honey, we've done business in small towns before. We can do that." Well, it didn't work out. And I guess my concern would be, in presenting numbers, and very attractive numbers, by the way, but because you may not have, is there one of the plants operating in the coastal zone of California? I guess would be a first question. And if not, do you have a full appreciation for how difficult the regulatory agencies in California can be, particularly in the coastal zone, and how much cost might that add? I think that the community, sometimes people from out of state just don't understand. They don't have a grasp of California, I guess.
You know, you're talking to the regulator.
Well, he said he wasn't here, though, when we started. So I was a regulator for 7 years in California, and I was a county regulator. No, you're right on the money. I mean, it is a tough market. I mean, you get 9 regional water quality control boards. You get 58 counties. I mean, yeah, things are definitely run differently in all those different regions. As far as an installation, yeah, we have a couple of installations. One at a very high-profile spot down in Malibu, California. It's at Paradise Cove Beach Cafe, which, if you've ever seen the Rockford Files, where his trailer was, that's where Paradise Cove Beach Cafe is. And we have a very large treatment system there and the effluent sewer collection system. So that, don't quote me, I think that's Region 4 that's in, which is the L.A. Basin, It's a tough region. One of the other areas that we have an effluent sewer in is in the Monterey area. It's at, I believe the name of it is La Cañada Woods, which was Clint Eastwood's subdivision up there. And they used effluent sewer on that. But the treatment system, I think, was a sequencing batch reactor, and they did reuse on the golf course. So we got some experience down here.
Thank you. Ms. Tarnowski?
Hi, Lynette Tarnowski, Los Osos. I'd like to know if you could give me any...
Is that
was a retrofit.
That was a retrofit. Now, we've done a lot of small communities, Glide, Oregon being one of them, which currently, I think it's 600 or 650 connections. Elkton, Oregon is around 100 connections. And one of the things I think to kind of appreciate where Orenco has been is that the terminology small flows technology gets applied to what it is that we do. And when you think about that and you have a lower population base, you have a much higher risk of failure if your equipment doesn't work. Or as Mike pointed out in our presentation, if you have high operation and maintenance or repair and replacement costs, because you don't have a large population base to buffer any of that cost. And so we have 25 years of working in small communities where our technology has worked very, very well. We've heard, though, from the competition, it's like, well, it doesn't scale up. It doesn't scale up. Well, no, it does. It scales up. I think, I don't know if where that comment really comes from. It may be hydraulics, you know, and we can address the hydraulics. Now, what was the second question?
So you've really just put in one of these systems of a retrofit for someplace this large?
Oh, no. No, I mean, we put in a Camas, Washington, which they are... I don't know what the initial number of systems was that they actually installed on when that system went in, which was over, I think it was like in the early 90s. But that system right now is at like 2,000 connections, but it's sized for 30,000 connections.
Okay.
In Camas, Washington.
Then the second question, was there more? I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Go ahead. I can keep going, but you kind of have to, you know, cut me off.
The second question was, if somebody else finances this, you know, private money comes in.
Yeah.
Do we ever get the treatment plant back again to get the...
Yeah.
And is a CCC credit rating going to be a problem?
Oh. Well, I'm going to answer your first question, which is, in our plan, we would hope that in 25 to 30 years, it would sunset and you would own it.
So we'd own it in 25 to 30 years, and
yeah.
So is then we'd get the income.
Or less, but yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay, and then a CCC credit rating, is that going to be a problem?
I'm not going to say it's not going to be a problem. I mean, there are going to be requirements that we can meet, but we've run this by our backer. And you know, they looked at it and they said, "No, we can work with that, but
what would the percentage be?
Percentage
of the cost of the money
on the as far as an interest rate?
Yes.
Oh, I can't tell you what that would be exactly. I know it's I don't even know that we would guesstimate, would we?
No, I mean typically too we've been talking.
The financing options, the design, build, and I don't know if you're going to be operating the system, if that's part of the proposal, or if that's down the road to make such a proposal. But I don't know if the question has been answered about the 218 vote, and if we're required to have a 218 vote, and how that would fit in. And then also on the financing, I know that when you do have a project that doesn't have the state revolving fund loan strings attached, you have a lot more freedom in what you can select for technology. And while it still has to be, where it still has to be something that is acceptable, as it can't just be, you know, dig a hole in the ground and throw water in there unless it's, you know, set up, engineered, and it's acceptable technology. I guess my question has to do with the 218 vote, the way you're going to finance this, because I see this as an option to be looking at from a financing perspective as much as from any kind of technology or treatment end. So, yeah.
As far as the 218 vote, I would have to defer to President Schicker on that, because I don't have a definitive answer for you on that.
So what would your company need in the way of a secured loan? I mean, you have to have something that secures the loan.
We own the asset.
You own the asset?
Right.
And so then it would be in a term of returning that in 20 years?
Yeah.
Okay. And so on the question that the previous speaker mentioned about a revenue stream, the revenue stream that you're going to be getting from the payments from the people who are making the payments to buy back this system or to buy this system, then they would not have be running this like a typical enterprise fund. They would just be, this would be a totally privatized project over a 20-year period. Is that what you're proposing? And in that time, you would be operating it, correct?
Well, not necessarily. obviously, the rates are the mechanism to pay back the investment made by the private consortium. But the operator can be a public entity. The operator could be a private entity, potentially, and it's really too early to define which way it looks now. And there definitely would be some input from the financial partner because they would want a reputable operator in there, too. So so that discussion hasn't happened yet, so it's a little
and
tough.
And so in that scenario, if the operator was the CSD, then the CSD would have the O&M costs, the O&M charges would return to them so that they could fund
Absolutely. That. Right.
So the capital investment would be going to you. The operating money would be the revenue stream for the enterprise fund so that they could operate the system.
Right.
Correct?
That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
Okay. And when would there be more information on the financial side? Because, the design-build issues are important, but I would like to see some follow-up to this workshop so that we would find out what exactly your financing arm needs from the community.
We've already told you too much. We need an RFP.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And then just from the
cost of the expense of the 100 plus or minus a month, is the treatment site all bundled into this?
As far as an RFP process, the ones that I'm familiar with, they require a couple occurrences of advertising, and then to go through the formal process itself. I think the quickest I've seen one ever done is about 3 months, and I don't know. I mean, the board here probably has more experience in how quickly they've dealt with it, but I've seen them done as quickly as 3 months. And as far as the cost, the $100, yeah, what we've done is we've broken out the different components, so you actually have a portion of that going to O&M, and then you have a portion going back to pay back the debts on what the capital costs were. What else do we have? Well, obviously that's pretty key. If we have a private group making an investment, now the interesting thing is there is not an O&M cost until you're connected, so that can be separated. And normally the language that we would use is a base charge and a usage charge, and the base charge would include the cost of financing, and it could be applicable almost immediately. If you want a successful program, if you defer it, it's just going to push up the price of the program, so you probably want that base charge in place as quickly as possible, whether you've connected or not. Basically based on the fact that it's available. So if you're looking at what your base charge would be, we said $45 to $50. There may be a $45 to $50 base charge that starts paying back the debt.
Thank you. And then there was one last question that Ms. Kelly asked, and that was about the treatment issues and expecting a high level of treatment. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, and again, we understand that the state board is going to require the regional water quality board's going to require a certain discharge limit, and obviously in the RFP we would address that and we would hit that. I think also to answer, I'm sorry, I don't remember your first, your Lynette Tornowski. The other question is you were asking about some of the requirements, you know, of our lender. It would be our hope that the CSD, the county, and the state would all, you know, that they would all be working together to make this work. Because from your line of questioning, I think that we're picking up on the fact that what you see also is that speed here is crucial. And that's from some of the documents that I've read from the state. That's exactly what they've been saying, is that, hey, it's all about speed. Well, this can be a very quick process to getting you a solution. Yeah, financing. I'm sorry. One more thing about speed. Our financial backer had said that on a project of around this size, that going through the process of qualifying and working with a community like this, that within 3 months we could get the finance put in place.
Joyce Albright, Los Osos. I have one question before I start. Will public comment be allowed at any future meetings before the November 7th election? Yes, is that you? It definitely will be? Great. Deadline when the sewer gets over to the county? Is that the plan?
I would have to defer to.
Is that the plan, to try to get it in before the county takes it over? And then you would avoid the Proposition 118 vote.
I think Mr. Director Senate and Director Sasania have both made that clear that that's not our intention at all.
And what about the Tri-W site then? It will, the assessments on the Tri-W site, will you be returning those to the community? Or, that's a big issue. It seems that some people have paid, $3,000 a head? And, of course, I've paid every month. So what's going to happen to that money if you put in this system? Well, it all has to do with the citizens and what they're paying, doesn't it?
I think the point of tonight, though, is to comment on this presentation, not on issues.
Well, this
not
is related. Public comment as well. Is that correct?
No, I'm sorry. It's not.
Also, there is no public comment tonight? Oh, you said it was public comment. I watched it on television.
Okay, let me clarify for you, Ms. Albright. Uh-huh. This is a special meeting. We're having a special workshop, and we're asking questions and comments about their presentation. And what I did say, if I made a mistake, I apologize, but we're having public comment on November 2nd, and you're surely welcome to come then.
On November 2nd.
That's a regular meeting, and you're welcome to come at that time to speak about those things.
I would like to ask regarding the New Times article today claiming collusion between Julie and Jeff Edwards.
Okay, you can put the microphone down.
Were you involved in that as well?
Cut the mic.
Was quiet.
Good evening, Chuck Varela.
Mr. Varela, could you hang on for a second? We have the mic cut off for a second. Just hang on. Ms. Albright, if you're going to disrupt the meeting, you're going to have to leave. Okay, you ready? Okay, roll.
Mr. All right, Varela. Once again, Chuck Varela. I have some real concerns about the total cost for this project, and I'm just going to cover about five of those, and maybe you can address them. You said that the current septic tank retrofit was not a viable alternative. So the thought comes to mind is the cost for retrofitting the current septic systems for each property owner would be considerably more than what the projected cost was. That's one item. The cost of the property for your treatment sites, was that included in the in your projections? And I didn't hear any cost about the to dispense with its discharge. And naturally, you're coupling a lot of residences with the 1/4 horsepower. How far can you transfer that effluent out of town when we're talking 2 or 3 miles down the road?
As far as is what we used for the cost on site, it's actually in consideration of a complete replacement. So we've used a budget, just a number of $5,000, which is pretty conservative. If you were looking at retrofitting an existing tank, that cost is probably closer to three.
Yeah, probably. But then you got the cost of I&I or potential
right. I&I. I mean, the cost, if you were just looking purely at using an existing tank and putting our pump system inside that tank, probably drop the cost about $3,000. So it'd be about a $2,000 difference. We've used $5,000 in our cost estimate. And when I was talking about would I recommend using the existing tank, probably not. I don't think for the $2,000 savings that the risk is probably worth it. You do run the risk of those tanks leaking. I mean, existing septic tanks aren't built to the standards that we would recommend. A lot of them don't have reinforcing in them. And frankly, a lot of them will leak. So we want a watertight tank in there. So we're not basing it on the lower number. We're actually basing it on the higher number. As far as a cost for a treatment site, is that included? You're talking about the real estate cost? No, it's not. Now, I guess, and really, we're not in a position where we could even analyze that. We do know that you own property already, and we offer an opportunity that you could use existing public property wherever it is, potentially. Now, I know that there's issues that I don't think we even understand as far as approving those properties, but our system is built that if you have a public park and you want to put treatment in the back corner of that park to irrigate soccer fields, the system is actually built on that type of concept. So it's difficult for us to say if you have to purchase property or not at this point. I don't know. The cost of nitrogen removal would not be in there at this point. So if we had an add-on module, there is a cost to that. It's pretty difficult without knowing what our permit limits are going to be and what our disposal is going to be to comment on what that cost is, because it's going to be highly dependent on how the regulatory side looks at it. And I know that's not, I mean, I don't even.
We could get there. But
we could probably get a range, yeah, at most.
We could include that pretty quickly.
Yeah. Recharging the groundwater. I wasn't quite sure what you were meaning there. Are you concerned that it's not occurring, or? Well, there's a disposal number in there.
So the answer would be no.
Well, no, we actually have the treatment cost is based on treatment and disposal. So our rough budget number is about how much pressure loss you have in that pipe. So on a smaller pipe, if you're pumping large volumes of fluid through it, you're going to lose pressure very rapidly. Since we don't have solids to settle out, what that means is we're not as concerned about the velocity of that fluid going through the pipe, which means that if you had to pump a long, long distance, and I'm talking 10 miles, you can increase the size of the pipe to reach that distance. We have systems right now pumping over 7 miles.
Without additional pumps.
Okay, thank you. Before Mr. Swanson come on up, I'd like to ask that the conversations in the room kind of go back down. It's really distracting. It's really distracting for the audience in front trying to listen to the answers and the questions. Thank you. Mr. Swanson?
Keith Swanson, Los Osos. It's going to be more common, I guess. We're facing $40,000 to $50,000 per property. You've made in your presentation about other areas where the public just was outraged by the cost of the gravity sewer or any sewer, and there was an uproar, and they stopped it. Gee, how familiar that is. And how right that was to do. You mentioned about the properties, Tri-W, it's assessment money, meaning that it can be sold to purchase other properties somewhere else, and that's what it can be confined to be used for, not for anything else. One of the things I would like to know is if there's been a cost comparison for this in an on-site system, because I know that Renko also makes on-site systems, and how, if that would be a benefit to the community, because one of the things that I think sort of a shortfall of the Ripley plan is the water returning back to Los Osos. And I understand that you wanted to do dispersion here in the community, and you know, perhaps something like this would may work in Quarter Acres if you can find that. And I think the biggest issue for me and STEP and why I support STEP is that sludge is a huge issue now and forever. And the old project would have been forever, trucks going out of town and no place to go. And at least this way we can have a way of doing that. And can you give an estimate of, you know, you said 60 to 70%, but you're actually talking about, I guess what I want is separate the collection, because I think that's a concern, and also because Ripley's proposed an oxidation ditch as being their means of treatment so that we can reach Title 22 and also get the nitrates where we need them to go. As far as an in-round run around the county, or God forbid we go against AB 2701, this is an option to the community that all stemmed from, as the difficulties that resulted from stopping the project. And if this CSD can come up with a solution that bypasses that, and God forbid we save a lot of money doing so, and actually do it environmentally responsibly, I think that's a great way to go. I can't see why anyone would oppose this. And to privatize a sewer is a very interesting concept.
You know, the concept of using on-sites is not a new one either. In fact, the Florida Keys is a question that if you want nitrogen reduction, can you do it efficiently in an on-site system? And I think the jury's still out on that. It's you need a larger system to do it cost effectively. As far as what the cost is for an on-site system, typically our on-site packages ranged in the $15,000 to $20,000 range installed. You can get aerobic treatment units, ATUs, probably $12,000 to $15,000 maybe. And then if you analyze both of those systems, you're going to find out that the ATU systems have a pretty high operating cost. They're pretty energy intensive. You have to pump the tanks fairly regularly with sludge to keep them operating efficiently. And there is a cost to that. And the Advantex systems, when they're scaled down to that size, will be cheaper to operate, but you'll have the higher capital cost. We believe that you're going to be much cheaper going to more of a distributed system where you're putting the treatment and taking benefit of a little bit larger scale. But all that said, one of the neat things, I guess, is that you can, it's the same technology whether you do it for one house, do it for 10 houses, or do it for 6,000 houses. It's just being scaled to whatever you need to do. So if you have a small area that only has one house or three houses, and it's going to cost you $5,000 to run a line in there, then you can put an on-site system because that may be the cheapest way to go. Does that cover everything you need?
No, there's sludge.
Oh.
Yes.
I don't know if I'm going to be able to break that out for you, but let me give you a whole number instead of just, you know, breaking out the sludge or the septage that's created in the collection system versus the biosolids or the activated sludge that's created in the treatment process. Glide Oregon is the system that I had referenced when we first got started. It's 25 years old, 850 EDUs. It's got about 650 connections. And it is an oxidation ditch. So we bring all of our septage to that oxidation ditch, and we introduce it at low flow times when our organic loading is low on the plant, so we can just kind of feed it in as needed. On an annual basis, for 850 EDUs, it creates about 3.5 dry tons of solids, which works out to about 8.5 pounds per EDU. Now, to put that in perspective, Winston, Oregon, right down the plant, right down just about 15 miles away, activated sludge plant, 2,000 EDUs, creates 100 tons of 100 dry tons of biosolids,
which comes out to 100 pounds per EDU. So the difference is 8.5 pounds per EDU versus 100 pounds per EDU. So it's pretty significant in the biosolids management side of things. And then we just have to apply the cost. You know, what we do with it in Oregon is we can take that to a landfill because it's has the texture of sawdust. Because we don't create, you know, because we create so little biosolids or, you know, to deal with, we put them in a drying bed. And it dries in the sun, they pile them up, and once a year it's about a 10-yard dump truck takes it to the landfill.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Cooper?
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is for the board or you people. It's about educating. An earlier speaker talked about what the state and the regional boards would they accept this kind of system. And I was wondering how much education is done. I mean, is this presentation given to the county? Because the county engineer was very much in favor of gravity and didn't seem to understand a lot of the step. The presentation you did here was really clear and good, and I'm just wondering, I guess my question is the county going to see this presentation, or do you supply more information so they can be educated? I guess that's my question. Thank you.
Ms. Cooper, you might have missed the beginning, but I'm streaming, archiving, putting it on the website. We've given personal invites to everybody at the county, and we've had communication with the county that they are interested in this material. So we're bringing it to our liaison committee, we're bringing it to them, and we're making sure that it's included in the alternatives analysis. At least from our standpoint, we're requesting that it be included. We'd like it to be. So everything we can do to reach the county, we're doing.
Oh, okay. So yeah. When they have any questions, too, about it, because it seems like it's not quite understood by them. Thank you.
And we'd be happy to meet with any of them.
Thank you. Thank you. Right. Mr. Payne.
Good evening, Madam President, board, staff, and especially thank you for your presentation. On the operation and maintenance of this, you need one man with a pickup truck, and he can lift those pumps out without a winch, and et cetera. What would you say? He probably does other things during the day to use up his 8 hours a day. What do you think? What grade operator does he have to be?
I don't know under California law what grade operator you have to be to operate a SEP system. I'm not sure off the top of my head.
So I think one of those filter plants like they had planned for us, you needed a grade 4 or 5 operator, 24 hours a day. So that's 3 shifts, and
that adds up.
They make pretty good money at grade 5. I think you were talking to one recently, here tonight, answering some questions. So that, I don't know if you really entered that into the cost of operation and maintenance, but it is a big factor when you start hiring that class of labor for a filter. I'm losing my, I can't remember the name of these things,
for the treatment?
Yeah.
The Advantech system or the oxidation? MBR. Oh, the MBR.
Yeah,
oh,
MBR right. System. Yeah. So in that type of operator are expensive and they need one on duty 24 hours.
Right. I mean you're correct in saying that. I mean the labor involved in managing an MBR is fairly high because you're dealing with activated sludge. I mean you have a full activated sludge treatment plant prior to that MBR.
Okay.
So and then they're cleaning the membranes fairly often, wasting the sludge.
And I mean, adjusting process.
You know, there's.
So comparing the electric, it was way cheaper, and the homeowner paid for that himself, and
right,
and not all of those.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Payne. Next speaker, please.
Good evening, Sharon Frederick, Los Osos. Lisa, I'm going to hold you to your word that you'll have a public comments section on November 2nd. There hasn't been one for a very long time, and it shows the lack of open government. I didn't get a good answer, I guess, from either of you on your experience on the coast of California. I was watching your presentation at home, and there was a map. It was very quick, and I saw Nevada and a couple of other states. But California, if you could put that map up, I'd like to see where that is. And I heard you mention Paradise Cove in Malibu. How many homes did you put the step sag in Malibu? Because I understood Malibu had been sewered at some point. And
oh, no, that's not for all of Malibu.
Okay,
I mean, I want to make that clear. It's just for Paradise Cove.
And how many homes was that?
Boy, I want to say that the initial installation was for around 120, but they just expanded the system, and I don't know how much larger that is.
Okay. Well,
but it also includes a restaurant and some other things.
Okay, so for people at home, you can see California. The big blocks are Nevada, Utah. My glasses aren't that good up there in the Midwest. California seems pretty open. You mentioned Monterey, California. How many homes in Monterey did you put that in? You said something about an actor up there in Monterey.
The blue states are where our systems are.
That's right. I'm saying. Nevada, Utah.
The blue.
Oh, the blue states. Okay. So now in California again on the coastal part?
Yeah.
I heard Monterey and Paradise Cove.
And
is that it?
Near Malibu.
Any other thing in the coastal communities?
I mean, we have a lot of on-site systems.
Does the board hear that? We don't know about anybody on the coastal communities, Senate and Cessna. Would you look into that for me? Okay.
We're not hiring them tonight, ma'am.
Okay, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. Okay. The other issue that I had, my sense is that you're experts and you've done extensive research in the field. Are you aware that Olympia, Washington, is removing the step sag system and replacing it with a gravity system? Are you familiar with that community?
I'm real familiar with it.
And are you familiar with what's happening there?
You better believe it.
Okay, so we'd like to hear some more about that.
What would you like to hear?
What happened with their step sag system?
What happened with it?
Bad contractors, wasn't you?
No, ma'am, it wasn't.
Can't blame you for that. All right, very good. So we still don't have a clear sense. I heard a couple of people ask this question, how many people actually were in the coastal community in California, and the numbers of homes that were put in. I've heard about 150 was one of the numbers. I haven't heard anything about 5,000 homes. So that's something that would really be neat to look in. And I do want to say that I think this entire session, and I hate for you guys to get dragged into our politics, was about getting Cessna and Senate elected.
I heard that you point out coastal communities that are actually affluent communities using an effluent system.
Thank you. Yes.
Just a clarification for me, many of those places that you spoke about in Florida, like the Florida Keys, are as coastal as it gets. With EPA and with other agencies, and I know the regulations in Florida. I have regulator friends in Florida, and
Charlotte County is a great example. There's 130,000 people. I want to say that 90% of the population is in elevation 10 feet or less, water table at 4 feet, in a hurricane zone. That's one of the actually STEM. Our installations throughout the country. Tons of them are in coastal zones. So I'm not sure. In our last visit to the Keys, we were brought there by the EPA. They asked us to come down. So the EPA is actually a very big supporter of ours.
I mean, these are federal laws that regulate clean water in this country, and that's part of the issue. And these are coastal issues around the country. And they are. This is one way to treat wastewater in coastal areas of the country. Mr. Cagle.
I want to address Olympia as simply as I possibly can. And that,
just a second, everybody. Thank you.
There are political issues that go beyond technology and the functioning of the technology and all of these other kinds of things.
the most simple way that I can answer what's going on in Olympia is that they have a letter from us that states that because they have purported to say that they have issues with high operation and maintenance costs. Now, we can find no evidence of their high operation and maintenance costs, so they have an offer on the table from Orenco to manage their effluent sewer for them for $11 a month. So I just kind of want to end any Olympia comments by stating that we're a company that's willing to, you know, to step up in the face of things that, hey, it wasn't in our control, but we were willing to make do whatever we could.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Miller.
Good evening. I like the presentation. I'm always looking for a knight on a white horse, and as I was listening, I wondered what questions I should be asking. That's what I always ask myself when it's something new to me. What questions should I be asking? And usually I ask the person, what questions should I be asking you? It sounded to me that you didn't have information that we need to have the nitrites level lowered, right? Nitrogen lowered, and that is one of our number one problem that we have. So, and it sounded to me that you didn't have the information that we want the water treated so we can use it again. Okay, those were my ears how I was hearing things, and you hesitated when questioned about your ability to get financial approval for us with our seriously bad credit. That's how I'm hearing and hearing everything. And so my question is, were you as surprised as you appeared to be?
Okay, I'll answer the last question first, which is no, I'm not. I wasn't surprised. The nitrogen question and the treatment question, we can hit those limits. There's not a doubt in our mind that we can hit those limits. I have a technical background, so I tend to want to back up and get technical and explain the process. That's probably what you were picking up on, is that I wanted to say, no, our process is just like, it will hit those nitrogen limits just like any other process will, and we use a lot of the same mechanisms in order to hit those nitrogen limits. Or
we just
to hit
want
those
to know how much limits. More money it's going to cost us.
And we can calculate that pretty quickly. There was one more question that I missed, though. What was it? Oh, you said I hesitated. My hesitation wasn't such that, you know, would we be able to? No, we've already spoken with our partner, and they've said yes, but there's conditions. Because, you know, we would have to go through a credit review and a credit check, and we would like to see, there will be some requirements that we would discuss more specifically at the appropriate time when we receive an RFP with you, with the people of Los Osos and the CST board. So, and again, one of them is, it's not a requirement, but it would be great to have the CST, the county, and the state all on the same page and everybody working together, so we can quickly get you a solution.
I agree.
Okay.
Thank you. Next speaker, please.
Hello, I'm Lawson Schaller from Los Osos. Good evening to everyone. That was a good presentation, an interesting option. And I think there were a lot of good questions and some good answers. I think there'll be more questions. I know I'll have more. It's usually the case for me is the next day. Why didn't I ask that? So do you have, I'm sure you do have a website with frequently asked questions, and is there an email address or a phone number, some sort of contact that we can?
Yeah, you can reach us at, you want me to give you the number, or I can have President Schicker post it. Our toll-free number is 800-348-9843. And then our website is www.oren.org.
nco.com.
Okay.
We have an online document library that you're more than welcome to log into and cruise around in there. We do have frequently asked questions. And then you've got my name, you've got Mike's name.
Okay.
We've got a whole team of engineers and customer Great. Service people that can answer questions.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
We'll put their contact information on our website as well, if it's okay with you.
Hello, my name is Alon Perlman, and I live in the Prohibition Zone. I was at home a little while earlier, and while I did read the agenda for today, where it clearly said there would be no public comment, and that was actually mentioned at one point that there would be no public comment, at some point in time it was said we will take a 10-minute break and adjourn for questions and public comment. So I...
Mr. Perlman, can I interrupt for a second?
Can you stop the time?
Yeah, please stop the clock for Mr. Perlman. You have plenty of time. Public comment related to the special agenda item. That's what I meant. That's all it meant. You know, I think you're familiar with our meetings, and we do this all the time. General public comment is when we have our regular meetings, which the next regular meeting is November 2nd. We have one a month, as we have this whole year. Okay.
I actually enjoy it. I enjoy Joyce Albright's performances. I just was disappointed when it was interrupted. I will answer. Malibu. There's lots of actors in Malibu, but we have some here too. But I will ask you questions. I'm going to be asking you a question about AB 885, and I'll give it. You'll probably be able to work on it right now. What would be a good regulatory strategy in that AB 885 is going to come in, and everybody who isn't in the prohibition zone may or may not want to tie into a system. How expandable? You were asked whether you could support 5,000 houses, but I think the water boards haven't really looked at the relationship between the areas that they can sewer. They started off with this grand idea that everything in California is going to be sewered. It's really that simple.
Yeah.
And now they're running into trouble.
Yeah.
And this county is really a minor bump as far as that's concerned, but they will run into more trouble. So don't answer it yet. Keep thinking about it. But AB 885, its relationship to a strategy to and how expandable is the other question. I'd like to go back and have you confirm some information. I have it right here, and what I mean, not in my head, it's on my cap. It says Santa Maria Diesel. We had a sewer plant that was going to pump, that was going to take a lot of sludge out and basically cross the county line. I think that whatever sewer is going to come in here, the county is going to have to answer the question is, do we have a contract with a landfill to be able to take care of all the sludge? Oh, and this is how systems will be compared, the sludge coming out of Tri-W versus the sludge coming out of your system. So if you could sort of crunch the numbers a little bit, or at least address the relative amount. Thank you very much. Oh, sorry.
How often do you pump the tanks?
There's an element of that. You said that the septic tanks have to be pumped out at a certain frequency, if you could explain that.
Oh, sure. Okay, on the 885, you and I could probably talk about that all night long, and I don't... I guess it could be a good strategy. I think there were good intentions that were going into 885. There's still a big struggle over what the final outcome of 885 is ultimately going to look like. But I can tell you this, that if they continue, especially if they start going towards advanced treatment systems
and there's more and more of them being put in the state without any type of proper operation and maintenance and responsible management entities in place, it's not going to work. So what's nice about what we're talking about here, and I don't want to mix apples and oranges, because we're talking about a sewer project versus individual septic, you know, individual advanced treatment systems. We're talking about a CSD. We're talking about something that's properly managed and maintained, and it's under a proper authority that's regulated. That I haven't seen defined yet in 885. I think they have some good intentions, but I don't know where that's ultimately going to end up. Me being an ex-regulator, sometimes those good intentions didn't get followed up with proper enforcement. And that, again, is where a thing like that can really have some big holes in it. That's what happened down in the Florida Keys, is that, again, the whole thing was formed with good intentions. They had an on-site program that I thought they had put together very, very well, but they couldn't follow it up with the enforcement. So did I answer your question with 885?
I don't have enough of an answer, but could you go on to the
actual
what somebody called conveyance? Because really, the real problem isn't as much. It's how high up a hill you're going to carry it, and whether diesel trucks are going to carry it out. What is the actual wastage that's moving out of the prohibition zone? I mean, or rather, the
what could be
the sewer construct, which will be actually outside the prohibition
zone.
But what's moving outside 5 miles away from here? What has to be shipped out?
Okay.
And what is its nature? And please use the Tri-W, which I think you are familiar with some of the numbers out of there, possibly, to answer that.
I don't know if I was familiar with that or not on the Tri-W numbers. I'm not actually familiar with those numbers on the Tri-W, but as far as the consistency, let me just kind of address, I guess, in a sequential manner how that works is the septage at the homes in the sep tank. If you're looking at a 1,500-gallon tank that and an occupancy in a household of approximately four people, you'll be at a pump-out interval of between 10 and 12 years on that, and that's at about a 95% confidence level. So 95 out of 100 homes would operate right in that range, plus or minus. It's on an average, but 95 out of 100 homes would be. So you're not going to have septage on day one. You've got time to plan, and you do have time to strategize to, well, where is this going to go? Now, ultimately, you know, obviously in our RFP or in our response, we'd have that all worked out, and we'd know exactly what our costs would be to manage those biosolids that would be created not only at the plant but also in the septage that would ultimately be created in the next decade within those tanks. The consistency of what you're talking about, the example again that I can give you is Glide, Oregon, where it's a step system that goes to an oxidation ditch, and it's approximately 8.5 pounds dry weight of solids that's created per equivalent dwelling unit. So because it's so small, and that's total, that's septage and that's biosolids at the plant, because it's such a small amount, we put it in a drying bed, and it has the consistency of like sawdust. That's what it would look like, a black sawdust or something like that. Now, as far as crossing county lines, we haven't done enough research to know on that.
Okay. Mr. Perlman, if you have more questions, could we take it up afterwards? Thank you so much. We have more business to do tonight, and so we want to keep moving so everyone has a chance to have comments and questions.
Good evening. My name is this on? My name is Al Barrow, and I wanted to point out to you that this community voted for a step collection system in 1998. We formed this district. There was a show in this room on a Saturday before the election, before we actually formed our community services district. And 87% of the vote was in favor of it. Now, they weren't voting on a step collection system, but that's what was proposed. I wanted you to know that. This is not the hard sell it sounds like. Not to me, anyway. But Having said that, I would like you to do some things for us real quickly. Before the meeting, you explained to me why the private money cost is just about equal to the state revolving fund money cost. I think the citizens need to understand that. And let me just run through these questions, if you don't mind writing them down, and then I'll sit down and let you answer them. We can use the existing environmental permits for a lot of this, I believe. Mr. Cecenia, is that not, that might be a question for you. The size of the building, as you have on the screen, is for 340 units, is a quarter acre. That would nicely take care of our Vista Doral and Bay Ridge Estates that have been fined $6.6 million. That would be an easy fix there, I think. And they do have effluent places where they can put their effluent for reuse, and that leads to my next question, is how did you, in Charlotte County, how did you use beneficial reuse? And the reason why it's so important to us is because we have to stop pumping our aquifer because we have saltwater intrusion. So we want whatever project we have to accomplish those goals. You said the capital cost was about $45 million for this project. Can you elaborate on that a little bit for the public? And then I would like to point out that we were actually buying a sewer over a 20-year period, and then we will own that after 20 years. So our costs would then just be operation and maintenance, which gives us a pretty rosy future. And that's all I have. And thank you very much for a great presentation. This is our first turnkey project presentation.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Barrow.
I believe what Mr. Barrow was talking about on the private money versus the public money, and I'll give you an example that I'm familiar with is one of the questions that we would get is, well, what's the rate? And in working with our finance partner on a conventional loan, which would be like an asset-backed loan. That is tax exempt. It was around a $2 million project. The loan that I had got for them was around 4.7% interest, and based upon a credit check, once they passed the credit check, funding could be in place in 10 days. The other thing about the loan is that they only paid interest on the money that they used. Now contrast that, that's 4.7% interest, okay? Contrast that to, but the other thing that they were looking at was a state revolving fund loan. For lack of better terms, origination fees that the engineer and the lawyer were charging just to fill out the paperwork to apply for the loan was about $20,000 each. So at $40,000 on a $2 million loan, you're looking at 2 points, right, on that loan. The SRF lending rate was 1.38. So take that, move that to 3.38. Took them 2 years to get the loan. So put an escalation rate on the money, I don't care, call it 2% per year. That loan is now at 7.3% or 7.8%, something like that. I'm sorry, it's getting late. So what we were looking at is, you know, speed. I mean, yeah, on the initial outlook, it looked like 4.7% wasn't that great of a rate, but it was a great rate when the time value of money was put into place. And that's really what I was describing to Mr. Barrow. The same thing applies with bond finance. I mean, you know, there's a lot of red tape on bonds. Bond origination fees can be a very high thing that doesn't typically get incorporated or doesn't get reviewed in bond finance as how does this apply to the interest rate. because you might have a $2 million loan, but your bond origination fees could be $500,000 on that $2 million loan. So, or it's probably not that high. I'm sorry, that's probably a high number, but it could be $100,000 or $200,000. So, okay, what was next?
You'd asked about the beneficial reuse program in Charlotte County. Predominantly, their sites were all golf courses. They did have a county park connected. They also had not single-family residential, but they had some multifamily complexes connected where they had common green space, and they were directly irrigated as well. And Florida has an interesting program is that the state actually provides matching grants towards any offsetting water use. And what I mean by that is if you have established uses like a golf course that may be pulling 1 million gallons a day out of an existing aquifer, they'll pay half the cost to put reuse in there in its place. And I'm not sure if California has anything at all close to that. But so we leveraged off that pretty heavily. And, you know, we talked a little bit earlier, somebody mentioned the residential reuse. Well, we'd looked at residential reuse, but there was a lot of issues with residential reuse, is that there was a big expense to putting in the pipes, and then there wasn't a guarantee that anybody would ever see benefit in connecting or install an irrigation system. So it's we never went there. We just didn't. We never reached a point where it had to be done. And I guess I mentioned before is that our bulk users were taking everything that we were producing. In fact, we had storage. We had a 180 million gallon storage reservoir that we stored reclaimed water during the wet season, and we distributed during the dry season to even leverage a little more off the resource. And I mentioned that earlier. It's a resource. If you can get that concept across that it's a resource and really build around it, it's, you know, you have something. But there is a cost, so that's where you have to balance it. On the $45 million, we actually pulled a lot of those numbers. We didn't want to go too far from the study that was done. And actually, I found the numbers to be a little bit conservative. But to try to break it down, I pulled out of there that it worked out to an average cost for the collection mains of around $2,000 per property. I would say that's actually fairly conservative. Normally, when we do quotes, we anticipate closer to $1,500, and we still think we're being conservative. Because you're not, to put, like I said before, we're fronting property with 2 and 4 inch mains. Typical costs on that can be less than $20 a foot. So if you do the math, if you have a 50 foot lot, and even if you're doing it $20 a foot, you're looking at $1,000 to front a property, divide it by two because there's a property across the road. I mean, it's cheap because it's pretty simplistic to put in. And then for treatment and disposal, the number that we would normally use in our quotes would be around $24 million for 6,000 homes. So the combination of those two is actually about $36 million. So $45 million is actually a pretty conservative number that we're using in the estimate.
Okay. Thank you for those answers. And that's the night. This will be really good to have on tape so people can listen later when they're not so tired and get more of the details. But you're having plenty of good information. So thank you very much for the details. It's wonderful. Mr. Cooper.
Bo Cooper. I want to thank the gentleman for the good presentation. I was delighted to hear that there's some possibilities that will work for me. In that regard, I want to thank this board for bringing this opportunity to hear these guys. The previous board would not have done that. I'm afraid a taxpayer watch board would not have give us this opportunity to explore options, so I appreciate that. Step stag has always been an idea that I thought was a good one. Certainly being out of town, I thought it has always been a good one. Most importantly to me, things I've been presenting was the idea of affordability. They have the 2% of the median household income, according to the EPA guidelines, has always been a clear guideline in my mind. I presented that before, and these are the first gentlemen who said, yeah, this is important. This is the key around which we'll build the plant to destroy we can't save the village by destroying it. You can't kick 40% of the people out. You haven't done anything good. If you work around the people who are here and save the community, then you've done something good. So I appreciate that they could do that kind of thing. The only thing that makes, and so that's that, that the people who resist this, I have a hard time understanding. The only thing I could, the only thing that I come up with is the idea of the gentrification of Los Osos, the idea that, yes, let's keep everything high. Let's throw the people out of the community. Let's get rid of the riffraff so that we can increase our tax base, so that we can get the rich people in here, so we can do that kind of thing. The economic cleansing is only, it's one of the few things that makes sense to me about why anybody would resist wonderful ideas like this. Explore them, do the science, do the social engineering, but to get rid of people the way it appears that the opposition is saying is very sad to me. So I appreciate the board here bringing the options to us that work for the people, to let the people stay and let the people prosper. Thank you very much.
Ms. Shaw?
Hi, Susan Shaw, and wonderful presentation. Just wonderful. I just think this is great. Let's do it now. And, you know, the boring is 3 feet, 3, 4 feet boring, instead of 20-foot huge trenches that collapse in sand. That's incredible, because in my septic system, I'm talking too loud, my septic system, after the earthquake, which you were talking about natural disasters, after the earthquake, my septic system quit working. And I had it pumped, and they said your leach field wasn't working. And then I had it pumped again. And then I had it inspected, and they found a broken pipe. So it was from the earthquake. So if we have these shallow pipes boring through the town, much less money, and we have a monitoring system I'm talking to these guys. Should I be talking to you guys? No. And we have this monitoring system that detects these problems. Who would have a problem with that? I mean, and also, the price is right. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Michelle. Ms. Ricard?
Just two questions. With privatized funding, would that mean, in terms of our credit rating, would that be based more on what the CSD's credit rating is or the community's ability to pay? And then the second question is, you talked about Hurricane Charlie a few years ago. In our area, the catastrophic disasters are likely to be earthquake, maybe flood. How would the system hold up those kind of scenarios? Thanks.
Well, the financing takes a lot different model, too. Essentially, it's a component of the rate structure. And while the credit rating is certainly evaluated by the financial partner we work with, it's not like a financial institution that makes that the only reason. Because they've told us that, you know, utility rates are a fairly safe investment. People pay their utility bills. and so they look at it a little different than a bank would. But we can't answer for them.
No, I can't.
But, that's essentially what we understand.
I will say they do have a willingness, though, and they're excited also about this opportunity. So, good.
And in regards to the disaster, it's interesting too, because you can design a little better too for earthquakes. Polyethylene pipe is a pipe that we would say we would probably recommend for a pressure main. And the reason I say that is I heard earlier that a pipe broke during an earthquake. Well, it's because it's a rigid pipe. It can crack. If it's stressed, it's going to do that. Polyethylene pipe's more like a rubber hose. It's flexible. It moves with the ground. And because the system's pressurized, that would be something that you can build into the system, because it doesn't move. It matter if it moves a little bit, it's going to stay intact. It's not going to fracture. So there's a whole lot of opportunities to safeguard it. An application like this is just good engineering.
Ms. Okay, would anyone else like to speak who hasn't had a chance to speak? Lots of good questions tonight from the audience. I appreciate all the detailed questions and your patience and the excellent answers and the detailed answers, too.
I guess we exhausted them.
Yeah, I think so.
That takes a lot.
I think Director Sennett has another question or comment.
Yes. Regarding any discharge fines, if there were any to occur with a private consortium actually operating the system, would they be responsible for the fines? Or would the CSD carry the discharge permit? Or how would that work? And also, maybe you could work it in with, would this private consortium operate under the California Public Utilities Code?
I think, actually, as far as whether they would be responsible, I would anticipate it's actually under their operating license if you have a contract operator. So I'd have to assume that, you know, however you write the contract, it would hold them responsible and hold you harmless. And with regards to how they're regulated, I mean, we kind of had that discussion as well. I mean, if they're a private utility, I don't know, is there a PSC in the state of California, or is there? Yeah. Having said that, though, if they're a contract operator to you and you're a public entity that sets rates, I would think that the ability to monitor rates and would actually revert back to the local government. There are cases that I'm familiar with in Florida where they have a private operator under a public utility, and the public utility sets the rates.
Any other questions or comments from the board? Just a big thank you. Yeah, just a really big thank you.
Thank you very much.
Everybody. Okay, we're going to go really quickly to the consent calendar because it's a short item. But before we do, Director Tacker has some comments.
Okay. What I think I'll do is make my director's comment into a recusal, because I'm going to leave. I'm not commenting about this item, Mr. Swanson. I'd like to apologize to the presenters. I did get caught in a conversation in the back of the room. I did ask Ms. Albright to go outside with me, but she refused and continued to talk. So I wanted to express my apologies to our speakers. Ms. Albright brought up today's New Times, and I hadn't read it, so I have sought out a copy and have read it. And so I wanted to, there's a small column about part of the reason why I will be recusing myself from this item. I have recently become employed as an independent contractor for the J.H. Edwards Company as an environmental permit consultant just this last September. In this column, it reports that I lobbied this board for a particular sewer plant location soon after the recall. And you'll remember that that was September of 2005. So a year later, I have some employment with J.H. Edwards Company. This article is irresponsible as far as reporting goes, in that there's innuendo and just no facts to back it up. If the reporter had called me, because I had a great interest in the Tri-W site, the Broderson site, in the history of the sewer and why why would anyone choose the downtown location for a sewer? Many, many people have often said, follow the money. It was a land deal. Okay? So through the course of my research, I learned in 2000, before any environmental impact work had even commenced or been, the consultants had been hired to pursue a site analysis, RCSD began negotiations for purchase of the Tri-W site, for purchase from Tri-W Properties. Tri-W is the former Williams brothers, three brothers, W, all having their last name be Williams, had a real estate company in South County and owned that property. Tri-W is how the name evolved. RCSD entered into negotiations with the Tri-W real estate company out of South County. Hamner and Jewell are the real estate company that represented the interest of the district in the purchase of both Tri-W, Broderson, and so on, many other properties Hamner and Jewell handled that the district purchased with bond money, as Ms. Albright was trying to allude to, that somehow those who paid, we're all paying, I'm paying, we've all paid towards the bonds. Some paid up front, some will pay over the course of the next 30 years. What you get for that money is coastal real estate. You also have sewer design. You have many studies. We have some PR that some of us didn't agree with. Lots of things were that money was spent on. And you do have equity in some of what that money purchased. In the Broderson property, Jeff Edwards, J.H. Edwards Company, handled the seller position. He handled the purchase or the sale for the Broderson property. He's a licensed real estate broker. That's where his financial interest, that's where he made some money. Okay? He now has a plan for a sewer. He's advertising as part of his campaign outside of town, and the site that he supports is a site that I did suggest our board look at as well as other sites, and I would not support choosing a site without environmental analysis. And the Ripley project has not gone through environmental analysis. So we still don't have a preferred site, in my opinion. I'm recusing myself from the consent calendar because Mr. Edwards represents Mr. Farbstein on his project. And like I said, I'm an independent contractor now for Mr. Edwards. So thank you all. Good night. I'm going to go home.
Thank you, Director Tecker. Would the board like to take a quick break before the consent calendar? No. No? Keep going? Okay, let's just take a pause while Ms. Tecker recuses herself. Okay, yeah, we're going to take a 3-minute break. Very short.
What's the chance I can get a copy?
Okay, because this is a consent item, would anyone from the staff like to introduce this to us and discuss it? Ms. Vega, how about you? Introduce the topic.
The staff report prepared by George Milliness pretty much outlines the history of this WILSERV application and the fact that it has gone before the board three times in 2005, and each time was postponed and not heard. And so he has updated his staff report, and he's included as attachments the previous staff report, the resolution, and the draft conditional will serve were both prepared with legal counsel at the time, John Seitz. And so it has been pretty much gone through for legalities. And Mr. Murphy, I know, has a copy of the information also, so if there were any questions regarding any of that. I know from George's letter, his staff report, he has included in here that there are many conditions within this conditional will serve letter that would need to be met from all of the regulatory agencies, including the county and the Coastal Commission, and all the issues are laid out there, so that the district would be completely covered as far as the final will serve would not ever be issued unless all of those other things in the resolution and also in the conditional will serve letter had been met. George at this point sees it as ministerial in nature, and that's why he's bringing it to the board under consent. George did mention in his letter of this month that he had discussed the matter with the Water Operations Committee and that they had agreed that this should move forward. So I don't know if the Water Ops, anyone is still here who wants to comment on it, but I wasn't there, but that's what his letter states.
Thank you, Mrs. Vega, very much. Director Cesena, you were at the Water Ops Committee? Could you report what you...
Yes, I was. I think that the committee saw this as a ministerial action, that there are many conditions built into both the Water Board letter and resolution that should satisfy any of our concerns. I mean, this isn't a land use issue for us, unfortunately, in my own heart, because I would be looking at it a lot differently if it were. But it is water service only. And so that's kind of what we have to limit our scope to.
Okay. Are there any other questions from the board? Or comments?
Has the applicant verified that their original permit has been kept valid, hasn't expired? The original permit with the county, as that was one of the conditions, and I don't see verification.
Is the applicant here? Are you the applicant, sir? Oh, okay.
The other thing I should have probably mentioned in my comments earlier is that Mr. David DeBink is here tonight. He also had provided some written comments to the board electronically today that I did put in front of each of you tonight, and there's additional copies on the table for the public. And Mr. DeBink has been consistently in opposition to this project and to obviously to anything that the district would do to promote the project. And he is here to comment on his opposition to it. But as far as the permit expiration, I know that at the time that Mr. Seitz put together this resolution, which was a little over a year ago, the county's position was that there was a valid permit in place. I don't know if any of that's changed since then.
What date was that, Kern, till that notification from county?
It would have had to have been done sometime before the board saw this last year in 2005. Seitz wrote this letter to the Water Board in April of 2005. So I believe that his work on this issue would have started in the spring of 2005.
Okay, let's hear from the public right now. Mr. DeBink, did you want to start? I'm sorry, I didn't recognize you. Sorry.
I guess I couldn't. I'm David DeBink from Los Osos, and I will try to. You had a 3-minute break, as I recall. I'll try to not use that kind of a 3 minutes as I make my comments. If you would like to have information on the validity of the permits, I could do that, but I wasn't going to address that issue. I recognize that we're talking about a ministerial action, and while I have many concerns about the project itself, I'm going to limit myself to talking about water supply issues. There's just one side comment that the project plan that was given to you by Mr. Edwards is for a project that was revoked by the Coastal Commission in November 15th of 1988, and therefore there is no way that he could build the plan that he's given to you. And in the case of a ministerial action, putting in a proper application would be your first step. But I'm going to go ahead and just talk about water supply. And we know that we have many conditions on this, and I just would like to have you add one more. And actually, this is a condition that had been placed on the project by the county engineers back in the days of CSA 9A, and it predates the CSD. The county master plan has a goal of looping water lines in Los Osos, and specifically at this site, as described on page 3-7 of their 1997 EIR for this project. And the plan diagram is attached to the material. And Karen, I truly appreciate the turning around this stuff. And if you lack the diagrams, let me just present two of them to you. I'm going to quickly. The diagram here is basically showing first the location of the project and then the I'll go faster. The county approvals on this included a line extension requirement that you are now dropping or is omitted in this. And quoting from the engineer's letter on this, Edwards was required to, and I would suggest you add this as a condition, extend a 6-inch water main a distance equivalent to that running along the entire frontage of his parcel, it's lot 32. This requirement is typical for any property owner requesting service that's not currently served from an existing main. In particular, our requirement is that the developer will have a 6-inch main extension designed and installed from the end point of the existing main at 10th Street to a point adjacent to our proposed waterline easement, which is currently an existing drainage easement, which runs along Gary Freiberg's property, and he was sorry that he could not be here this evening. He had other plans. They will do this installation before a will serve letter will be issued by the engineering department. The engineering department, maybe I should now phrase this as a question. There seemed to be unlimited time for questions earlier. I'll try to do my best on this. May I have a few moments?
You may, please. Could you please continue.
I apologize. I end up with some scatological comments at the beginning that I now regret. But anyway, the engineering department will later design and have installed the section of water line which will complete the looping on block 22. Costs contributed by the developer for the length of the water main extending from the point adjacent to the easement to the end of the property frontage will be applied by the district toward the design and construction of the loop line. So essentially the idea was that instead of paying for putting a line all the way from the present end of 10th Street down to the Santa Paula Street, that they would basically take the equivalent amount of money and use it to finish off the loop in the alignment that's shown in green in the diagram that I gave to you. And the desirability of such things is unquestioned. There are two things that we're missing now, and I would suggest you restore them. The two things are the county required the developer to construct the water line extension before the final will serve letter would be issued. And they also required the set aside of the funds to pay for this completion of the loop. Dropping these requirements directly affects the future health and safety of our neighborhood, and moreover, the elimination of the condition on the payment set-asides is really just a gift to Mr. Edwards. When the other lots at the end of 10th Street are developed and the loop is completed, it will be the ratepayers of the district that make up the shortfall. The engineers in the letter that I gave to you, or actually Karen gave to you, noted that the loop completion eliminates water quality problems and health concerns due to stagnant water, eliminates the need for periodic flushing of dead-end lines, now an ongoing maintenance difficulty, and enhances the available fire flow capacity of hydrants located in the looped area. And I would suggest that such adding this condition, the same one that the county already did before, would certainly fit within the ability of this board as a ministerial action. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeBing. Any questions? Okay. Thank you. That's good to hear. Okay, Mr. Barrow.
Thank you. I'd just like to comment on the looping idea. I was at the Water Ops Committee when the WilSERV permit was discussed, and Mr. Edwards seemed reluctant to do the looping. I think he stated that he wasn't going to do the looping. And it is a health hazard because when you have a pipe that doesn't have a complete flow, the water stops at the end. There's some sediment. There's some coating on the pipe, an opportunity for bacteria to form in the pipe. And there's also the chlorine bleaches out and becomes ineffective if it's going to sit there for a long period of time. So I felt like Mr. Edwards was trying to get a little something. I was really shocked when I saw the map of the property, and it's sitting in the middle of an ESHA. That, to me, why does the district have to give a WilSERV permit when all the rest of the permits are not in place? I think this process is a little backwards. I know I'm probably wrong, but you can correct me, Karen.
Actually, this is a conditional WilSERV letter, and the conditions in the WilSERV letter are that all of the other permits and regulations have to be complied with before we issue the final, which means that the person can get service. It's basically just saying, if you do all of these other things, yes, we have the capacity to serve you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Swanson.
Okay. Now, Keith Swanson, sorry, no, so, so, you write that down now? Sorry. Is he not able to go through the rest of the planning process and the project process without a WilSERV letter or with an intent for WilSERV? Because the two problems here are, one, he can't have a septic system because he violates the prohibition zone, and we're allegedly running out of water, though the county hasn't recognized that, so therefore actually there is water. But I'm just wondering, is it kind of backwards? I guess Mr. Barrow is that, why doesn't he go through the rest of the project? Or it, from what I understand, is the Coastal Commission is going back, wait a minute, you don't have water and sewer. Well, then don't give it to him. Because he can't have either. Until he, you know, it's, I guess, the issue with most of the property owners here, vacant lot owners, is that they're waiting for a sewer so that they can build or some solution. I think he just has to get in line with everybody else. But if there is a, it just doesn't ring true to me. And I know that the CSD has struggled with this. I know that Mr. Seitz, I know, has struggled with this, and it's been, you know, going through whatever it's going through. But just think about it. It seems a little backwards to me, but, you know, that's just me. Thanks.
Thanks, Ms. Owen.
Lindy Owen, Los Osos. Being on the water ops, what I understood came out of that was that George Milanis felt Mr. Edwards was requesting to have, I think, three of the special conditions removed, and they were the most difficult ones and probably ones that he will not be able to meet. And so what John Seitz had set up with the original list of special conditions George Milanis, director of the Utilities Department, felt that that was adequate. These will all have to be addressed before he gets his will serve. And it looks like the list is so severe that he will not be able to get it until things radically change in Los Osos, and it could be years. So that was why I believe the consensus of most of the group was to go ahead and agree. It is backwards, but at the same time, the only thing that the asset that I see that Mr. Edwards gets out of it is that he will have a more valuable piece of property, but it's many years from ever getting through all of those, that list of special conditions. And while we're on the subject of Mr. Edwards, this article that came out, his half a page ad that came out, he notes that the Love Farm, which is the belongs to the Gorbys and it's on the outskirts of town, he lists that it is one of the locations that could be used as a sewer and goes through an entire half of his ad here explaining it. I was contacted by someone who had me contact the Gorbys. Their property is not for sale. It never has been.
Mr. Edwards, I'm not sure this relates to the Farbstein will serve.
I think it relates a little bit to Mr. Edwards' style of operation, and all I would like to say then is that Mr. Edwards is proposing eminent domain if he thinks that this property is at all available for a sewer site. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dugan.
Dave Dugan, Los Osos. Being on the Water Ops Committee, that night was pretty lively. Jeff Edwards gave his five, almost 10-minute spiel on why we should take certain conditions out or probably not have any conditions at all. But looking at those conditions, which I believe was a combination of John Seitz and comments from the regional board, and looking at all those conditions, he's going to have to jump through some major hoops, and I don't believe right away he's going to be able to satisfy all those conditions. My understanding, though, is that if you issue this conditional will serve, that, of course, he'll probably file a lawsuit, and that'll be one more. But I agree with these conditions because basically with the concerns of the regional board, I don't know how many bathrooms these projects are, but they're two plus or something like that, and they'll be adding discharges. And though that's not this purview of this hearing for waste discharge, at the same time, they want these conditions set. And so I think it was unanimous that at the committee meeting that to pass this will serve with these conditions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Perlman?
I'm not that familiar, along Perlman Prohibition Zone, I'm not that familiar with this, so I'll just make I'm not taking a side, but I would like to remind the board that the water that you don't sell belongs to the CSD. In other words, if something is permitted and if the looping conditions the water, then I think you should include wording that ensures that the water that isn't passing through the meters, essentially the water that still belongs to the CSD, is of the utmost quality. So if creating a loop is what preserves that quality, I think you should strongly identify that that is not a condition that can be removed, because ultimately, while you are in this capacity simply a provider of a service or a commodity, you have to ensure the rest of your commodity. So don't send good water to stay stagnant in pipes. But that's my suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you. Closing public comment on this item, bringing it back to the board. What say my fellow board members? Director Sennett.
Okay. This is kind of confusing, this exhibit. The current requirements require the 6-inch water main to be extended to a mentioned drainage easement. in Figure 3-2 of the project
out into a culvert, and then it just runs across the property right
so
now.
So he has to extend it and then...
The way it is now, all he would do is put the line like this.
But it says he has to extend it to here.
That's what it says, and okay, this number
then
eight.
Then it would be here.
Okay.
But what he is not being asked to do, the equivalent of this money, they would said should be applied to the design and construction of the other segment. And then this goes up the side of the existing house.
But there is no easement there, is it?
There is none there.
Okay. Well, we can't require that of them. Alex, I'll just... Thank you for the clarification. It appears that he will extend the main up to a drainage easement that borders his most southerly parcel boundary. And what I suggest is that we require him to take his lateral perpendicular to the water main. This isn't an exhibit I recognize. I don't know where it was. It's just a water map, water pipe map. So it's subject to the final approval of the utilities manager. So I trust he'll set it up so it facilitates the future maintenance, and you know, so we don't have water mains going every which way. They're more predictable to locate if they're, you know, truly lateral. They're perpendicular to the surface. From that point, it's Mr. Edwards' obligation, or whoever will develop that, to feed the properties with whatever means he wants to on his own property.
If I could jump in for a minute.
Sure.
If we're going to have this much discussion, we need to officially pull this off of the consent calendar.
Oh, okay. Well, okay, I'm happy with it.
I'm still a little bit concerned about the lack of looping the service lines. It seems like a good thing to do, and the less often we forego that, the better a system we have.
Okay, and for the record, this item is pulled off the consent calendar according to requirements. One board member is allowed to do it, right?
Right.
I did it. Okay.
Yeah.
For just discussion purposes. Okay. I have a question, too, for Mr. Dubink. I don't know what I'm looking for your paper here on your suggested changes and amendments to this. I don't see them. If you have a copy, could I see them? I'm not. This is difficult because it's 11:30 at night.
No,
we have no utilities manager. I have questions I can't answer. I've seen this thing five times now, you know, and I know what's this is not the way to do this. That's just my opinion. You guys have talked about it in water ops, but I don't have a map. I don't have your changes versus what's in here. Are your changes in here? Did you check? The map doesn't make sense. The description of what everyone's talking about, providing the board with a dinner donated from the high school. It was very kind. And thank you to Danielle and Anne and Karen. It was very kind. Okay, and now your closing comments. Excuse me.
I really enjoyed the presentation tonight. It's another option. It's a piece that we haven't seen before. We've seen the hardware and the technical aspects of that sort of proposal. It's fairly similar to what we've seen from Mr. Ripley and others. And I would like to remind people that the step collection system with an out-of-town treatment plant was the environmentally preferred plant in the existing EIR. So we're not talking about a new plan, essentially. We're going back to what had been studied and determined to be the environmentally preferred before. And that's important to keep in mind. What was brought to the table tonight is alternative financing. And I really think that that's something that we all should be interested in because it provides a quick way to get to the issue of cleaning up our water. And I'd like to thank those of you who stuck around to the end tonight. You're pretty amazing. And to the county and the water board and everyone else, we really just are interested in cooperating with all of our partners for the best solution for Los Osos. And I think that the people in this community will determine what that solution is. And I ask everyone to help us implement that. And thanks to the staff again and everybody else.
Thank you, Director Sinnott.
Thank you. Well, I think this opens up new opportunities for us, but the really kind of things that are coming into vogue now, it's very similar to a toll road. We're having companies come in and actually construct roads for us, and then they charge tolls, and then after, you know, after the beat to heck, no, they're turned back to the public holding. But these are new things that are coming about and allowing infrastructure improvements where there is no money to fund them. So in that respect, this might be a very, very, very good thing for us in the way of opening up an opportunity. Regarding a comment, there are people that seem to be throwing up roadblocks where there really aren't any. And I think this is going to be borne out with a frank discussion with real numbers and real scientific facts and real life situations. One of the problems that a speaker brought up was the creek crossings, and I can tell you as a permit engineer for the state of California, that I've approved crossings on creeks, over bridges, under channels. The state parks goes across San Simeon, or they go across Pico Creek Bridge. To believe that we would not be able to cross the creek, and if they found that Los Osos was so much more special than any place else, not to allow such a crossing, I think I would begin to start canceling permits and telling other operators that they can't cross our creeks within the state right-of-way because of the danger. No, I think it's more than practical. It's done. It's a reality. And this should not be something that prevents us from doing this, and it won't. So with that, I'll say good night, and thank you for coming.
Thank you. My comments. I also thank staff again for all their help this week, and thank the board and the audience again for participating in the workshop tonight. The points that stood out to me that I think are very important to remember are some that have been made, but that's this. The two issues that come up for this community more than anything about a wastewater treatment plant is that it be environmentally sensitive and affordable. Four times now in our history before I was involved with this, the environmentally preferred project and the least costly project was a step collection system out of town. It happened when the county had the project and they had a committee of 12 people who served on a technical task force and recommended to the county that a step collection out of town was the most affordable and most environmentally friendly. The CSD, when it was formed in 1998, ran on that ticket. Most of us who voted for the CSD voted for that project. Environmentally preferred, step collection out of town. Then the FEIR, the Final Environmental Impact Report, prepared by Crawford, Lontari, and Clark, and Montgomery, Watson, and Harza, once again recommended that the environmentally preferred project was step collection out of town treatment. That's the third time. Now the fourth time is with the Ripley Report. And if you want to count tonight, it wasn't really it was just an option to discuss to give you more detail about it. We've got the same thing coming out on top again. Now everybody's asking, why is this project taking so long? Why can't Los Osos get it together? Because I think the question needs to be asked, if the environmentally preferred and least costly alternative keeps getting ignored, why do you think we don't have a project yet? I think it's a very, very important reason
why we don't have a project, why it's taken 20, 30 years. Every time we get to a step collection, out of town, environmentally preferred affordable project, somehow it gets canned. That's a mystery. That's why I'm going to do my best to talk to the county, talk to the citizens, and show them this information and share this. I think it's all our responsibility. If this is indeed the wave of the future, we should be on that wave. We shouldn't be going back to gravity that's becoming outmoded. I have the textbook by the state's expert in wastewater treatment for small communities such as ours, and his name is George Tabonoglis. We talk about him all the time. In his book, for our size community, gravity is dead. Gravity system is not affordable for our community. And when you look at the 60-year life cycle example that was given tonight, hear your comments, speak at the Board of Supervisors meeting, speak to Mr. Paavo Ogren, who is the public manager of the project, speak to your representatives, and encourage them that these alternatives be considered with everything else. So thanks for coming again, and good night.